It's time for TWiNT This Week in Tech. Oh, I love this panel. I always say that, but it's true. Alan Malventano is here, former host of our This Week in Computer Hardware program. He is, of course, now the king of SSDs at Phison. Also here, Doc Rock, the king of video from Aloha, Hawaii. And then joining us from Worcester, Massachusetts, it's Daniel Rubino from the Windows Central website. He's the editor-in-chief over there. We will talk about Windows and Microsoft and the AI PC. Microsoft made a big deal about that. A little utility that many computers have that turns out to have been infested by malware and has caused kind of a crisis in the supply chain. I'll explain what you can do to protect yourself against it. We're also going to talk about new PCs, new AR glasses. Daniel's got a pick he really likes. And Alan is going to explain HBM, CXL, and NPUs. I think I got that right this time. It's all coming up next on TWiNT. This episode is brought to you by Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are now using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero trust AI.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiNT.
This is TWiNT, This Week in Tech, episode 973, recorded Sunday, March 31st, 2024. The Inverted Goldilocks Zone. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Wix Studio. I've got 60 seconds to tell you about Wix Studio, the web platform for agencies and enterprises. So here are a few things you can do from start to finish in a minute or less on Studio. Adapt your designs for every device with responsive AI. Expand Wix Studio's pre-made solutions with back-end and front-end APIs. Generate code and troubleshoot bugs with a built-in AI code assistant. Switch up the styling of hundreds of web pages. I mean fonts, layouts, colors, all in one click. Add no-code animations and gradient backgrounds right in the editor. Start a design library, package your code and UI in reusable full-stack apps. Oh, and one more big one, deliver everything your client needs in one smooth handover. Well, time's up, but the list just keeps on going. Step into Wix Studio, see for yourself. Go to wixwix.com/studio or click on the link on our show page and find out more. It's time for TWiNT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Great panel, as always. Daniel Rubino is here, editor-in-chief of Windows Central. Hi, Daniel. Good to see you. Oh, you're muted. You're silent. You're quiet.
Sorry.
No, that's good.
Got how computers work.
Oh, those things. Yes. Good to see you, Daniel. Where are you? Where, I forget. Where are you calling from?
Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
The beautiful Worcester.
It's getting there.
It's good. Slowly. I taught my kid how to say Worcester, and then when Gordon Ramsay on Idiot Sandwich tried to get him to say Worcestershire sauce, he knew how to say it better than Gordon Ramsay did.
Nice. Yes. But, we have very complicated towns in around this area, both Indian names as well as old British names. It's a lot of fun.
I grew up in Providence, so I know Worcester.
Oh, yeah.
W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R. You pronounce that. Yeah. Also here from the Aloha State, from beautiful Honolulu, Doc Rock. Good to see you, Doctor.
Hey. Good, good. And you know, Daniel, I spend a lot of time there because my company is headquartered in Amesbury. And I'm always like, I need to go to Target in Haverhill. And then be like, what?
Haverhill.
Or Peabody. The one that throws me off is watching the TV commercials about the Peabody, because that's what comes on the news. Like, you're looking for a Cadillac. Welcome to Peabody Cadillac.
Peabody.
I'm like, why not Peabody?
Peabody.
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 So that's like Cochituate. That's one of the Indian ones.
I love the area though. Good food.
There's a famous lake out here in Webster, where my mother is from, and it's based on an Indian name that has over 100 letters. And since she grew up in Worcester, Worcester Webster, she was able to say the whole name. It was like a thing you learned as a kid, and that was like how you proved you're like from the area.
Wow.
That's pretty
crazy.
Funny.
I'm gonna find out the next time I'm there, because my boss is a Merrimack historian, so he knows everything about the region.
Let me see if I can do it. Lake Chobanaga Gungamog. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's actually a longer version of it.
That's the short version. Here's the long one. Lake Charga Garga Manga Changa Banga Dwabunga Dunga Hungamog. Wow. Those Algonquins knew how to have fun with their tongues.
They sure did.
In fact, there's a bridge with the name of the lake on the bridge. And it goes. Oh, New England. Oh,
I think
New
we just
England.
Call it Webster Lake, but
yeah, I think by now they've probably changed it. Also here, great to have Alan Malventano from
Faison.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, what town? What town are you in right now?
Florence.
Florence, Nebraska? Florence,
Kentucky.
Kentucky. Hey, see, I never ask, because we all gotta gather together in this virtual space floating high above Petaluma, California, but it's kind of fun to know we're all over everywhere. It's great. It's really fun.
Yep. It's a suburb of Cincinnati, so it's basically Cincinnati.
Which is always confusing because you're in Kentucky, but it's just over the bridge to Cincinnati.
Right.
And so you can get chili anytime you want, or if you really want, you can have Derby pie. So you get the best of both worlds.
And the airport frequently referred to as the Cincinnati airport is actually on the other side of the river in Kentucky. And the airport code is CVG, which stands for Covington. It has nothing to do with Cincinnati.
Yeah, this is good. This is like a geography twit. This week in geography. Hello, everybody. So tomorrow is April Fool's Day. Daniel, I'm sure as an editor-in-chief, you dread this day.
Yeah, we don't really do these anymore.
No, but here's the good news. Most people have stopped, right?
Yeah. It was every once in a while you do something funny. I think Microsoft years ago put DOS on Windows Phone. That was kind of fun. But like, you know, sometimes, I don't know, it's just gotten out of hand. And I think some people have lost a sense of humor. Plus, you have to be so careful now not to be offensive. And it's so hard to tell jokes and not be offensive. So
yes,
I think most companies need to avoid it.
Google was famous for years doing the most elaborate. You felt like, guys, have you been working on this since last year?
All right.
Google Romance was one. A parody of online dating. For those who generally favor the, quote, throw enough stuff at the wall approach to online dating. That was in 2006. One that really sticks in my mind, I don't know why, is Google TISP for the Toilet Internet Service Provider, a free broadband service that would make use of sewage lines to provide internet connectivity. But the thing is, the pages would be so elaborate. And I, you know, the reason I thought you might not like it is because it's very hard to do journalism on April Fool's, or used to be anyway, hard to do journalism on April Fool's Day. We've kind of lost the impetus to do it, I guess. People just got tired of all the stupid stuff. But it was on April Fool's 2004 that Google released something that was not a April Fool's joke, although many of us thought it might be. This is the 20th anniversary of Gmail.
I remember that day.
Oh, God, yes. You and I are old enough. Actually, I think everybody on the panel probably remembers. I asked Micah. He was like 8. he has no memory, no knowledge of it at all. What is your memory of when Gmail was launched?
Oh, I got my invite from Kevin Rose.
Oh, nice.
And it was crazy because like it was like maybe the day or day after or the next day after launch, Kevin was doing a live show and he's like, I only got 5 invites. You know how it was back then, right? I only have 5 invites. And so it was somebody from the audience was going to get one of these invites. And I just happened to be one of the ones who got it. And then, it was, so I've literally been in Gmail since way back then.
It was so hot, those invites, because it was in beta. It was in beta for most of its 20 years. That people were selling them on eBay for hundreds of dollars. It was expensive.
That's so funny.
I know now. It's like, yeah. Most people out here have probably 20 or 30 Gmail accounts. This is the press release, April 1st. So we all, I mean, honestly, I think initially we all thought, no. Google gets the message. This is the actual press release from Google's news site. Google gets the message, launches Gmail. User complaint about existing services leads Google to create search-based webmail. Search is number 2 online activity. Email is number 1. Heck yeah, says Google founders. The inspiration for Gmail came from a Google user complaining about the poor quality of existing email services, recalled Larry Page, Google co-founder and president, products. She kvetched about spending all her time filing messages or trying to find them, Page said. And when she's not doing that, she has to delete email like crazy to stay under the obligatory 4 megabyte limit. So she asked, can't you people fix this? It was a big deal. They launched with a gigabyte of storage, which is remarkable.
And let's remember, at the time, it was, what, Hotmail and Yahoo Mail were the competitors? Oh, and probably AOL still, for those hanging AOL. On to their AOL. So it wasn't like great competition. So they really did come in and kind of innovate. It was also probably the first real FOMO on the internet, where with those invites, you know, like, was the first thing that I think people were like, oh, this is kind of like different, you know. It was just right when the internet was starting to go like really mainstream.
Alan, you have any memories of getting your first Gmail account?
I waited, didn't get an invite. I waited until it was open. And
wow. Because it took a long time, right? Before
it did take a long time, but I wasn't like in that much of a hurry because I had, at that time, I had like my own domain. So I was rolling my own email anyway.
Were you running your own server? Were you actually running your own server?
I don't remember if it was in my house or not at that point. It might have been. The capacity thing like didn't bother me so much then. But then eventually once I got into Gmail, I just switched over. And now here I am today. I think I'm sitting at 95% of my free. You know, I keep getting the warnings. Hey, you need to
buy some more storage, buddy.
So the good news is you can pay for it now.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Actually, it's kind of funny with the hosted thing, because if you remember back then, too, you could do hosted Outlook Exchange. And the reason people were doing that, including myself, was because that was the only way you can get push email.
Right.
As a lot of us would have Trios or handheld PDAs, it was the only way you can get emails pushed to your device, where you have to have your own remote hosted domain. So you had to go. You had to be a super nerd getting email like that back then. But it was a lot of fun.
Oh. Sorry, guilty. That was the reason I was doing it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Are you running an Exchange server, Alan?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Now, I've never done that, but it is reportedly the worst experience out there, right? There's no worse.
It was a learning experience. You know. That's how you learn the early frustrations
early
of
pain.
Dealing with your own self-hosted things, yes.
And the thing about Gmail was, I mean, it kind of made sense because we knew them as a search company. We've since learned they're an advertising company masquerading as a search company. But at the time, we thought it was all about search. So it made sense that they would say, we'll never throw out email. You have now a gigabyte. You could store all the email you'd ever want and search it quickly. And that was when I think people started thinking of email as more than just transient communication. So that's how we think of text messages now. But email,
it's a repository.
Yeah, it's like your contact database. It's your history. It's what you agreed to. It's a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, the other thing at the time that was also relatively relevant was if you were doing something on your computer with like Eudora or dealing with Yahoo or
Eudora. There's a name.
You were limited in the size of your attachments. And if I remember correctly, I think it was like 2 megabytes back then, but then Gmail had made it bigger. Gmail was closer to 10, eventually became 25. But that was the best place to send large attachments was at the time with Gmail.
You still use Gmail, Doc?
Oh, all day, every day.
Alan, you still use Gmail?
Yep.
Yeah.
Daniel, you still use Gmail?
Suites, whatever they call it now, all of that.
I use it officially for work because we have to have a Google Workspace, but for my personal one, I use Outlook.
Yeah. I use Fastmail, but I use Gmail for years. Actually, for a long time, I just as a spam filtering solution. I would have it forward through Gmail just to get rid of the spam and then have it go to my Fastmail account. But at work, we're Workspace, so I still have all of our Twitter accounts are Gmail.
No one uses Proton Mail here? I'm surprised.
You know, I think the whole idea of a email being private in any way is a little mistaken.
Yeah, that's how I thought too. I was just like, because they just got a Windows app now, so although it's basically a web app, but I was just kind of curious if anyone pays for.
I tell people if you shouldn't use email if you want to be secure, use Signal, basically.
Yeah.
You know, I think I have that in my like signature. It's email is not a secure, even with Proton Mail, which is basically kind of hanging encryption on top of email. I mean, I use PGP, but I don't think that's a good way to send secure messages. Plus, the metadata is visible. Use Signal. Or some nowadays there are more choices in Signal, including Apple's messages. Use a more strongly encrypted end-to-end solution. The biggest thing I think that Gmail was, besides the fact that a gigabyte seemed like an awful lot, and in those days that kind of opened our eyes to what was possible with cloud services. So it was probably one of the first cloud services most people experienced. But more than that, it was the first web app almost all of us experienced.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just a web page. It was an app.
True story.
You could right-click on a line in the email and on the list, and it would show you a menu.
Yeah.
Instead of just your browser right-click options. That was like a new thing. It's like, oh, wow.
I think Gmail does not get enough credit for introducing the world to the notion that you could have an app running on a website. Harry McCracken has a good article from 10 years ago, but it's still, I mean, the history hasn't changed about how Gmail happened and how it launched. And he talks a little bit about that. He quotes John Markoff saying, "The scuttlebutt is Google's about to offer a free email service." That leaked out March 31st, the day before. Gigabyte was 500 times what Hotmail was offering. A significant amount. But I think really, to me, the most important thing was you could go to a web. Did Yahoo have, I guess Yahoo had webmail. Hotmail had webmail. So maybe, but would you consider them web apps compared to what Gmail did?
No, their experience was so horrible, especially Hotmail. Hotmail's
had ads in there. That was a difference, right? They had actual visible banner ads and that kind of thing. They put ads in the email where Google didn't do that. They just sold your information instead.
Yeah.
So now it's flipped around, right? Now Microsoft doesn't sell your stuff to advertisers, although they use some data, but it's Google that's kind of the advertising email now.
Remember the days of people printing out an email and it always had like an ad for something weird in it?
Yeah.
And then so in a way, knowing what we know now, we kind of didn't really understand this back then. We thought they were just served, right? But knowing what we know now, somebody could print out an email and show it to you and you would see something weird in an advertisement. You know they were searching for that at some point that week. And it ended up in
Was there Cialis back then? I don't know.
There was Viagra, right? Very early on, you started getting emails that had V1@.
I don't know about you, Leo. I never got those. So I don't know what you were searching for.
Well, I'm a little older than you, and I think there's probably an age gate there. Created by Paul Buchheit, who is kind of a legendary guy. He's now a managing partner at Y Combinator. He's, it's a VC basically. But he created Gmail. He created AdSense, the original AdSense. And you may remember, I really liked it. He created something called Friend Feed. You remember Friend Feed?
Yes, I remember Friend Feed.
And his partner on Friend Feed was Brett Taylor, whose name you probably recognize as one of the Twitter board members who forced Elon Musk to buy Twitter, among other things. Brett gets around. Brett is kind of legendary. So he created Google Maps. So, yeah, there's...
The web app thing is fascinating, too, because if you think about it, you know, Apple, a few years after this, came out with the iPhone, famously didn't have apps, but they were, everything's going to be web-based. And, of course, that didn't work out. Everybody wanted apps, but now we're coming full circle here as Google has been leading the progressive web app kind of revolution that's been going on. All their services make really good PWAs at this point, and it seems like where everything is going. Now it's kind of funny that like apps are becoming like less important than that. The Proton Mail, as I was just remarking, is now on Windows. It's, I believe it's, might be in the store or not, but it's basically a web app, you know? So you're seeing a lot of these official apps come out, but they're just web-based technologies, which is fascinating.
I wish PWAs would take off. Google and Microsoft got behind it. Apple kind of put, you know, stuck their leg out and tripped them up a little bit by not supporting it well in Safari. And then Apple's kind of come and gone on whether they want to support it. On the one hand, they get a lot of money out of you buying apps in the App Store. So they're a little, but on the other hand, they're getting a lot of scrutiny for the App Store. And I think there are people within Apple say, you know, we really should support PWAs better because that would get the EU off our back. It would give third-party developers a chance to do something. And then there's parts of Apple that say, yeah, but then Epic would have an App Store and we'd be in trouble. So it's a shame because PWAs are actually... Do you have much experience with those, Daniel? It seems as if, given the right service workers, there's pretty much you can't. There's nothing you can't do.
No, they handle encryption. They can handle downloaded files. The big thing is like for video, right? If you're Netflix, do you want to download a movie for your flight? How would that be handled? So that technology is getting there. It's a work in progress. They keep coming out with different standards, but you know, so it's not like a finished technology, but it's getting to the point where, especially with the work Microsoft is doing, where it's, they're becoming indistinguishable almost from like a native app. So I think it still has a little ways to go, but Microsoft has like in the store, a lot of official apps are PWAs.
Well, and we know that you can do a lot because so many apps are Electron-based. All of the cross-platform apps almost are Electron-based, which is essentially just a Google browser with a web app all bundled together into one.
So the coolest thing with PWAs is because it's web-based, if you're using a browser that supports extensions, which is questionable on mobile, right? They're getting there, but at least on desktop, this is normal. You can run extensions within the app now. So you can run your Grammarly, you can run ad blockers, you can run different kind of scripting extensions. So now you can actually modify the app to your liking, which is something that's never been able to be done before.
My only experience with this is because, you know, some years ago, I think it's less important now, but at one point in podcasting, you know, you had to have iTunes and an iPod, but eventually it became obvious that, you know, you could have a website and apps. And pretty soon it seemed to me, especially with, you know, the success of the iPhone, that phone apps would be the kind of the future, and any podcast network should have a phone app. And we looked at writing custom phone apps. We actually hired a company to write custom Android and iOS apps. So after spending tens of thousands of dollars, it was so god-awful we could never release it. And I always thought a PWA would be the way to go. You browse to our website, and the browser says, okay, you want to put this on your home screen as an app, and now it's an app without much effort on our part using the same technologies we use to create the website. So I've always thought this would be great for that kind of use case.
It's really good for smaller independent companies, your local business, because they can just write once and it runs everywhere.
Exactly.
The app is technically updated in real time. If you update the website, it gets updated through the app. You know, so it's. I think it's a fantastic technology. I wish it, you know, I'm glad Microsoft and especially Google, of course, are supporting it. Hopefully Apple, Safari supports it, but they're always like a generation behind on their PWA like abilities.
It feels so half-hearted, you know, it feels like they're really
fine,
ambivalent. Yeah. Fine. Okay. Yeah. Which is pretty much Apple these days, isn't it? Fine. Yeah. If you insist. Okay. But we're still going to charge you 27%.
Right. Mm.
All right. Well, happy birthday to a Gmail, and share your Gmail memories with us. We're all still using it. It's kind of amazing. 20 years later, there aren't a whole lot of technologies that have survived 20 years.
Fully. I think the one thing that Gmail brought to people too, I don't think a lot of people realize this, but if you were a Roadrunner customer at the time, one of the most frustrating things were moving to, say, like a new computer, because a lot of people at that time, because of Roadrunner, were heavily pop oriented. Only the nerds, only the people who were running Exchange servers or who had built their own mail servers kind of knew anything about IMAP at the time, right?
Yeah.
I think that Gmail was one of the very first IMAP heavy, and you could even set the duality, set it so you could do both, because not even the services like Roadrunner, a lot of them didn't even have IMAP capabilities. So sometimes you had to cheat and kind of fake it. So you would bring the pop mail into Gmail in order, because your service didn't support IMAP. But I was ran into that trouble because I was working at Apple at the time. And whenever someone would get a new computer, their biggest fear was, am I going to lose all of my email?
Remember, remember you'd have to set the pop server to do not delete the mail.
Right. Yeah. So if you didn't know any better, you were losing mail.
Every time you download it, it all gets deleted. Yeah.
Right. And the other crazy thing about it at this time, which I remember very specifically, is Microsoft Office 2003 was just becoming super popular on the Mac side. But one of the things that was struggling is if you picked up a PST Office mail file, whatever it was called back then, from a Windows box, and you brought it over to the Mac side, if they got a lot of email, that thing would break.
Oh,
and then that controlled your mail, your
is
calendar.
PTSD for me, man. That
holler back.
Holy cow!
Yes, I spent so much time un-effing those for customers at the Apple Store that I used to have really lovely hair, like Daniel.
What is it about Microsoft? They love big binary files. They've got the registry, which just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And they've got the now Outlook. I think has kind of gotten away from the monolithic PST file, right? But your whole email, your calendars, your contacts, everything stored in one blob that broke
easily.
If
that thing ever reached 2 gigabytes, it would just break.
Yeah, well, that
and
was
some people would get lucky, but most of it was the threshold that I noticed the most anecdotally from doing all these repairs. It would hit 2 G's and it would be busted. And we would have to try to figure out how to, we have to download Thunderbird. And I think that's right. Is Mozilla called Thunderbird?
Yeah.
Yeah. You had to do like 6 different steps to try to bring out the individual pieces and put it back together. Oh my God, it was so frustrating. And I spent a lot of time doing that.
That was
so
crazy. Is that still a corporate culture thing, Daniel, at Microsoft? Because I feel like it goes all the way back to Bill Gates, who wanted to squeeze every bite out of everything. Word, for the longest time, would store your text files in a proprietary format that was run encoded. You couldn't open it and see ASCII. It was doing run encoding on it, I guess, to save space. It seems like that
you can still do that.
They still do that?
You can if you want to. The default now is it's basically like a form of a zip, like a compressed file, and then internally, internally there's basically like an RTF. You know, it's readable.
But,
you can go in and extract the contents.
Can you open it with a hex editor and see text? No.
If you extract it, then you have to look at the other files.
Right.
Yeah. Then you can open the individual files and actually get the text. Like, you don't even really need to hex edit it to do that.
I remember trying to decode Word files, and like the letter B, which is normally an ASCII 8-bit letter, was like 4 bits because they were doing some weird. It was just nutty. But I think it's so funny how corporate cultures persist. I mean, I'm very aware that these days, because of Apple and Steve Jobs' kind of paranoia and kind of closed mindset continues at Apple. And I think Bill Gates a little bit in his idea of wringing every ounce out of every bit persists maybe a little bit at Microsoft. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the weird limitations and things we see in history for computation just comes back to almost like the Millennium Bug, right? Which is things that people didn't anticipate how the hardware would evolve.
Yeah.
And so they didn't think ahead like what this was going to be like in 10, 15 years, right? So I think that's where a lot of this stuff just comes from. And yeah, they, you know, you get assigned a project, you have a deadline, you have managers, and, you know, corners get cut. You know, so I think there's a, it probably has to be books written about this topic, but yeah.
It's fascinating really to me. There is.
I still think the funniest one today that is very prevalent in the consumer side of it is the fact that a megabyte doesn't equal a megabyte when it's on a hard drive.
Yeah, it's 1,024 bytes. Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. I think that still throws customers to this very
close enough.
I just bought this 5 terabyte drive. When I open it, it says I only have 4.7 terabytes. Why? And then to us, it's funny, but like, to the, you understand why the customers expect that. So then I'm like, okay, hard drive manufacturers, make it 5.4 or 6, whatever, so that when they open it, it's actually 5. So it's less headache, because one of us always, anybody who's anywhere related to IT, you get a call every time somebody in your family buys a new hard drive.
I'm missing space.
I'm missing space. Exactly.
Wow. I can't even believe that we're still doing that.
It's too funny.
Yeah. You need a mebibyte.
At least lie to them, because they won't know anyway. Just lie to them. Do something, but stop me from having to get these phone calls, Seagate. I'm talking to you.
I like Metabyte. That's pretty good.
I think you still see this. So I believe there was some regulation that hard drive manufacturers had to start putting the decimal, because the decimal is 1,000 and the binary is 1,048. But then they came up with this M, lowercase I, capital B, the mebibyte. You probably know about that, Alan. You're a storage guy.
Yeah.
What's a mebibyte?
It's an SI units thing. Yeah, so it uses the power of 10 instead of the power of 2 increments. Right? So if you want to, and yes, it's used for hard disks, and then ironically enough, it's also used for SSDs. So SSDs, things that use flash memory, which you would think is like what you would do for RAM, do not do the thing that you would do for RAM, and they do that because usually SSDs have some over-provisioning to them, and so it kind of naturally fell into the typical percentage of over-provisioning that you would want to use for flash memory. Also happens to be what happens if you hack the 24 off of the 1024, right? So it just worked out that way. So now SSDs tend to use like, you know, the power of 10.
Even though you're going to get the power of 2 actual bytes.
The power of 2 is there, but it's not all accessible.
Oh.
Because if it were, the endurance of the drive would be lower because you'd be using more of the spares.
Here's something.
It usually wants to
a chart that I think will clear this up for everybody. You got your kilobyte, megabyte, gigabyte, terabyte, petabyte, exabyte, zettabyte, yottabyte. Then you got your kibibibyte, your mibibyte, your gibibyte, your tebibyte, your pebibyte, your exibibyte, your zebibyte, and your yobibyte. Why it's not a Yodi byte? I don't know. I guess it's too close to Yada byte. One's binary. Yeah. That's the B.
Dude, Yodi byte would be better just for the Star Wars nerds in the building.
What, and a Yoda byte?
Yes. Just to keep it inclusive, you need a Yada byte.
So a Yada byte is 10 to the 24th bytes.
The thing that was really annoying about all of that was that they supplanted the MIB in place of the exact use case where most people were using MB.
Right.
Already.
Right.
You know, you
so
have to go
I
way
see
back
this
in
on
time
drive.
That,
if you buy a drive, though, it has the MIB on it, right? Still. As well as the MB.
Hard drives will just use the standard.
They'll use the MB.
The
okay.
Yeah. Because they're based on decimal.
Right.
Increments.
Even though Doc's family is going to be confused when they open the drive.
Oh, 100%. Everybody's confused. And then not to get in Alan's wheelhouse, but every time I'm looking for a drive, I'm telling myself, I want to buy this SSD. What are you going to use it for? I want to use it for video. Okay, I need you to look for an SLC drive, but do not buy a QLC drive to do video. And they're like, I don't even know. I don't see that on the package. I'm like, oh, here we go.
Yep. So, yeah, so it gets even worse because in the SSD sphere, first, you have storage in general, which they like to do the power of 10 thing. Then you might have an SSD that has a base 2 type of, you know, it might be 1,024 gigabytes to make a terabyte instead of 1,000, right? But there will still be different products that use one or the other within the ecosystem.
So there's no consistency even.
Well, but it gets better. It gets better because for the data center, there's a different grade of data center storage, which has way more over-provisioning. So instead of 7% over-provisioning, it's 28% over-provisioning, and that doesn't fall under any rent, you know, typical 1,024 or 1,000. It goes down to, like, you know, 960 or 800 gigabytes for the same amount of NAND that was previously giving you a terabyte, right?
Can we talk about kittens for a minute? Actually, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will talk about bad April Fool's pranks that went south real quick. And most of them are of recent memory. We've got Daniel Rubino with us, editor-in-chief of Windows Central. Doc Rock, the doctor, youtube.com/DocRock, and Ecamm ambassador extraordinaire. We love Ecamm. And a sponsor, of course. And, of course, Alan Malventano, also a longtime friend, former host of This Week in Computer Hardware, the long-lost Twitch. Twitch went to the four winds because you and Ryan Patrick. Trout went to... Well, Pat... Okay, so you and Ryan Trout went to Intel. Patrick went to Missouri. And that was it. The whole thing was over.
Basically.
Anyway, it's great to have you back. I got to do this. Former Submariner, right?
Yeah.
With the United States Navy, yes. Right. Former intelligence expert contractor to the NSA.
And I wasn't a contractor then. I was still active duty.
Oh, okay. Well, what is that then? You were detached to the NSA? What is that?
No, it's just like any other duty station for the military, except the NSA was paying the military to have people work there, basically.
So Steve Gibson's been going on about the BDUs required for cyber experts in the intelligence agencies in the military. Did you have to wear camo BDUs?
Oh.
Do you remember?
I did as a medic.
Well,
which
see,
was
here's
really
the
stupid.
Thing. I was a chief when I was doing
you
wanna that job.
You want to see a medic? You want a big red cross on the back?
You had to wear that in the hospital, Leo. I work in the freaking Tripler Army Hospital
and wearing
battle dress uniform in an emergency room. It made about as much sense as screen doors on a submarine.
So it varies from command to command, but maybe now, because realize I've been out for you know, over 10 years.
Yeah.
But there was sort of this transition where initially there were no digital cami kind of uniforms.
Right. They have
and they started
now.
Introducing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then if it was a command that was a mostly office setting, then typically the command, like the captain, would just say, okay, this is the uniform everybody's going to wear. And so when I was working there, it was just regular, the traditional Navy uniform still. They didn't have everybody running around in the digital camis through, you know, blending in with the wallpaper.
This is basic military digital camouflage battle dress uniform. I don't know who you're hiding from. Maybe Mr. Smith. I don't know. But Steve Gibson thought that was very...
You'll see a lot of that in Hawaii, and it makes no sense because it's also 90-something degrees here. So you're basically... People were always coming there for heat exhaustion. I'm like, oh, what do you do? Oh, I work in air traffic control. So you're in the air conditioning unit all day, but then you got to wear this hot uniform. Oh. It made no sense. It's super stupid.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, we wore the regular. You know, I was a chief petty officer when I was working at the NSA. I just wore the khaki uniform that they have, which is just a khaki color.
Very nice.
Yeah. Navy does have the best uniforms.
Oh, I
agree.
Nobody looks better than a naval aviator. I tell you what, Submariner, intelligence officer, and flash memory guru. Mr. Alan Malventano. Our show today brought to you by Stepdog. You may say, wait a minute, you can't have a kitty cat with your stepdog. Oh, yes, you can. And I call her Samantha. She's monitoring. She even meows. Let me see if I can hear it if I tap her head. Meow for us. Small things amuse me. This is from DC Labs. It's their Apple Watch app. It's called Stepdog, a virtual pet that lives in your Apple Watch face and helps you track your steps. Your stepdog moves around you throughout the day. We had 15,000 steps yesterday. Lisa and I tired our stepdogs out. Boy, that was fun. It, not only that, it falls asleep once you hit this goal that you set. It goes to sleep. The app is free, but I pay the 99 cents a month so I could upgrade. They have over 30 different breeds, Labrador, Husky, German Shepherd, and cats. And you can name your stepdog or stepcat. Mine's Samantha, after our own cat. I love it. The upgrade has weather forecasts for dog walks, or your walks, and a leaderboard. So I could say right now I'm in third place with all the other stepdog wearers in our neighborhood. You can add your friends as well to this, winning gold, silver, and bronze medals each day. I'm not doing so well. I'm kind of, who's beating me? I can't. Somebody, Sammy is me, then my dog, and is that Gibbs or Globs is winning? But you can see, these are the, we're in competition. You know what? You might say this is silly, but it gets you walking. And it is kind of fun. It is kind of fun. Stepdog. It is a very, I haven't won any medals yet, but I will. I trust me, I will. Very sweet little watch face app, free to use from the App Store. Download it, install it, and get your watch barking or meowing with your steps. Stepdog from DC Labs. I love my little stepdog. All right, let's talk about April Fools that went wrong. Like March, early April 2018, when Elon Musk tweeted, let's see if the tweet's still there. I think it's not. He tweeted that Tesla was going bankrupt. No, that's a bad idea. That's a bad idea. This was shortly after a crash. The prank backfired immediately, according to USA Today, causing the stock to drop 7%. Even though he tried to inject humor in the way he phrased it, Elon's Easter eggs pun wildly misfired. Okay. You may remember Volkswagen. Remember? They said they were changing their name from Volkswagen to Volkswagen because of their commitment to electric vehicles. This was just a few years ago, 2021. They said, oh, no, it's an April Fool's Day joke. But no one got it. Everybody thought it was real. The Taco Liberty Bell April Fool's prank. In 1996, they took out newspaper ads. It's a little early for the internet, including in USA Today and the New York Times, saying they had purchased the Liberty Bell and were renaming it the Taco Liberty Bell to help out the national debt. Members of Congress, always the sharpest tools in the shed, called the National Park Service to see if that was true. According to the Washington Post, the Park Service actually had to have a press conference to deny it.
That one's actually funny.
It's pretty funny.
I like that one.
Pretty, pretty funny. Google had one in 2016, a new Gmail feature. You know, remember this one? The mic drop. What was that?
that's super goofy. I just funny to me, but it was like, you know, you have these friends that when you have a conversation, somebody always got to have a last word, right? There's a mic drop person in every group. So they had a way to get the last word in the email thread with the mic drop feature. It was super stupid.
There was a special mic drop emoji that you would click that they said it never happened. And that would be it. It would be over. Conversation over. Mic drop. Boom.
Oh, my God. That was good. That was funny.
Get the last word on any email. Just send your message with a new mic drop button. Everyone will see your response and this GIF, but no one will be able to say anything. By the way, is that something from a Despicable Me? There must have been a little cross promo with Despicable Me. So many fun, not so fun.
Everyone tries to bring back something cool, but I don't think anybody's done it really well recently.
It's not cool. Like, it's not cool.
Yeah, none of them are memorable. Even the 7-Eleven, I don't even remember what year it was, but the Tiny Gulp, that was just stupid.
Yeah, they had a big gulp and a tiny gulp.
That the tiny gulp. It was really, really dumb. I don't even remember how long ago that was, but yeah.
But you remember it.
None of them ever work. They always fall flat. So it'd be funny to see what anybody tries tomorrow.
Here's the the big gulp machine, and then there's a little tiny gulp.
Oh, that was 2022. Okay, so that was during the pandemic. Okay.
So I think, though, it was really the pandemic that kind of put the kibosh on this. We just weren't in the mood for a few years.
Yeah, nobody was ready for giggles.
I hope it doesn't come back. I don't know about you, Daniel, but if you've got to do news coverage on April 1st, it's hard because you don't know what to believe.
Yeah, it's gotten a little bit better now. Companies are being a little bit more transparent, but like sometimes this stuff is just so ridiculous. There's like just no way, you know, but it's true. I mean, for a little while, there was this kind of gray area where it's like, wait, is this real or not? Yeah, it's just become, I don't know, it becomes corny because after a while, it's just this like PR stunt that companies do. And it's always done by a committee. Right. And it's just like,
there's no humor.
You know, at some point it might've been funny, but then by the time it gets through everything, it's been corporatized and it's just lame.
Dr. Du in our Discord says corporate humor often lands like jokes in a Samsung event.
Yeah. Exactly. You're right. Yeah, there you go.
What's better, and we don't push enough, and I wish we did, again, as the resident tech for everybody's family, and most of you guys are probably in the same position, is Worldwide Backup Day, which is today.
Oh, happy Worldwide Backup Day.
Like, every 31st, I got into this because of Kelly Gumont when I was at TUAW. Like, she used to always, Kelly, like, make sure that we celebrated it on High Verso. And ever since her reminding us that, I've always been telling everybody, like, Worldwide Backup Day is important. That's today. Because I swear within the next week, and everybody in this table, someone's going to call you and go, hey, man, I just lost some files on this. You know how to get it back?
Should you only back up once a year, Doc?
Oh, no. No, but it's a reminder. It's reminder to catch up.
I think some people might say, oh, good, I'll do my backup today. Every year I do a backup on April 31st or March 31st. No.
Listen, even if they did that, that would be better for many of the cases that come to
that's
me.
True.
Thank you. Right? There's people that just don't do it, and then they wonder why, like, oh, I can't get my pictures back from my phone. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry.
It's kind of funny. Like, I was just kind of going through our own coverage. And I remember actually now it was last year, Asus kind of announced the ROG Ally handheld gaming unit right around. It was going to be announced officially on April 1st as a Steam Deck competitor. And no one in media was briefed on.
Nobody believed it.
And so, no one believed it. So it was covered initially as an April Fool's joke, but it became very real.
It can bite you.
On April 3rd.
It was real.
Yeah. Yep.
I feel like World Backup Day might be sponsored by Facebook only because when I go to worldbackupday.com and there's a thing that says share your pledge. So you can make a pledge, right? I solemnly swear to back up my most important documents and precious memories on March 31st. Hashtag World Backup Day. But the only take the pledge button is on WhatsApp. Not Twitter, not Threads, not Blue Sky, not WhatsApp. Why would I pledge this on WhatsApp? Am I missing something? Dumb. That's bizarre. So I feel like maybe World Backup Day has a sponsor.
Well, it says Amazon Mega.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
iStorage Backblaze. Well, see, that's why I know about it, too, because I've been Backblaze since day one.
Yeah, that
guy is
sense.
One of the nicest people on the planet.
That's who should sponsor this is the storage guys. Yeah. Where the places where you would back up. Actually, we should probably talk about, I don't know if you're going to have to tell your family about this or not, but people who listen to this show, techies should know about, probably already do know about, a pretty serious issue in a widely used utility that actually has a very interesting story behind it. The utility is called XZ. It's an unzipping utility or a zipping utility that you probably don't use. Most people don't. But that is on many, many machines. And by the way, it's not just Linux. It's on many, many Macintoshes, too. In fact, as soon as I found out about this, I updated Homebrew and it downgraded my copy of XZ, which was being used by third-party utilities. The one that really matters is OpenSSH, which does use the XZ utils. Now, the story behind this is fascinating. It actually started years ago a committer, JIAT75, got into the good graces of the maintainer of this program, who was anxious to retire, as is often the case with open source library software. The guy who was working on it was tired and was doing it all by himself, even though it was widely used by all sorts of programs everywhere. So when Gia came along and said, hey, let me help out, he was glad to take the help. The committer committed reasonable, useful fixes for some years, eventually earning the trust of the maintainer, who did in fact retire. At which point, this guy Gia had kind of full reign and introduced a backdoor into XZ, which would give him or bad actors a backdoor into SSH, a remote code execution vulnerability. It took him years to work his way in, worm his way into this, take it over. And then when he submitted his updates, it was always obfuscated. So it wasn't immediately obvious what was going on. Gia Tan, it's a pseudonym. It could be a group. It could be, and I think this is most likely a nation state. This is someone with a lot of patience playing a very long game. In February, 2 months ago, Gia Tan approached other Linux distribution maintainers saying, you got to put this XZ that we were working on in your stuff under the guise of great new features. It didn't really need new features. It had been, the software was done. And people put it in. Now, here's the most kind of depressing and surprising thing. It was only discovered because a Microsoft, not researcher, an engineer who had a little bit of OCD was kind of annoyed that his SSH was taking half a second longer. He benchmarked it, Andres Freund, and he posted to the OSS security mailing list saying, I'm getting some weird performance issues and Valgrind crashes. And it was only when he noticed this slowdown and they started looking at the code that he realized, oh my God, there's a backdoor in here. It underscores what Steve Gibson and others have called a supply chain vulnerability that has never really been addressed. Almost all software, closed and open source, uses libraries. Many of these libraries are open source. They're maintained by individuals, groups, unpaid, usually working in obscurity. And many of these libraries, including the Python PyPy library, have been infiltrated by exploits. They replace existing code with malicious code, or in this case, this is a remarkable case, but it might not be the only one. A backdoor introduced over a period of years into a widely used but very widely unknown utility. So most of the Linux distros have been updated. As I said, Homebrew has been, well, it's really downgraded. There is no fixed version of XZ, but there is a previous version prior to his intrusion, and it works just fine. And so they, at least Homebrew, when I ran it, downgraded it. Just a fascinating story. Here's Andres Freund's Mastodon post. He says, I was doing some micro benchmark. I accidentally found a security issue while benchmarking Postgres changes. He said, I was doing some micro benchmarking at the time, needed to quiesce the system to reduce noise. Saw SSHD processes were using a surprising amount of CPU despite immediately failing because of wrong usernames. Profiled SSHD, the SSH daemon, showing lots of CPU time in libLzima with perf unable to attribute it to a symbol. Got suspicious, recalled that I'd seen an odd Valgrind compliant in automated testing of Postgres a few weeks earlier after package updates. Thank God this guy's paying attention.
The real shame of this is that the only reason it was really caught is just because that developer was sloppy.
Yeah. Which makes me think, here's the thing that worries me. I think this is widespread. We know it's widespread. There have been, I think, literally thousands of attempts to put malicious code in PyPI. We've talked about this before. There is really no fix for this supply chain vulnerability, and nobody's doing anything about it. Alan,
it's a legitimate complaint because any particular distribution or collection of different packages, at the end of the day, somebody has to make the judgment call. Oh, okay, we really want this particular thing included. All right, well, once you're doing, for example, SSH, right? So the SSH, whoever's maintaining that, at some point said, well, we want this other thing included.
Right.
And then it just that, and whenever the audit gets done on SSH, it doesn't include all of the sub packages that are included because the assumption is that all of those other packages have their own audits going on. So it's really a matter of resources, right? How many resources are there available for any particular project to not just look at that project, but everything underneath it that's being included and also keep that up to date every time there's a new update to that other dependency? Do you go, you know, how often are you going back and auditing that as well, right?
I would think at this point, there have been so many cases of this in PyPI and other libraries that people know about and have kind of ignored. I would think at this point now people would start to sit up and say, we need to have some sort of validating system before random people can But this is how open source works, is random people submitting code pulls, right? I don't know what the answer is. Let me just look up the... we've talked about this 2 days ago. PyPI, 500-plus typo squat fakes malicious code in the supply chain. 500 fake packages with similar names to popular ones. Now, people who write Python code will frequently download libraries from PyPI and run them without, you don't vet it. You just run it. It's a library. Everybody knows it's okay. 500 of them. And if you had a slight typo you might get a poison package in your library and not even know it. Mm-hmm. And I don't see a whole lot being done to fix it. I don't even know if something can be done to fix it. This is a vector, the very powerful vector for bad guys. When this happened 2 days ago, PyPI halted new projects for 10 hours. But it was only 10 hours. Right? I just don't know.
It's just about increasing your... obviously there'll be some lessons learned. They'll go, okay, we need better audits. We need different resources allocated to these things. We have to be more particular about which things we decide to allow, and it's just all you can do for something like this in hindsight, all you can do is take it as a learning experience and update the procedures to try to
A week ago, prevent it. 170,000 users said to be caught up in a poisoned Python package ruse. According to the register, this was a Python package for Discord bot makers. 170,000 users had data stolen from their browsers, Discord app, crypto wallets, and files because of a malicious Python package uploaded in November of 2022. These people play the long game, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, I'm sure Steve will talk quite a bit about this on Tuesday. It's a really interesting story, and the patience and determination required by the malware actor is fascinating. These universal repositories are incredibly useful for anybody who does coding. I use libraries all the time, and you just assume, well, they must be okay. Everybody uses them. They're well-known. And I just don't know what the solution is. I really don't. SSH is so important for security. It's used by so many things. You may not know that you're using XZ or SSH, but you might well be. People use SSH to log into their Synology NASs, for instance. I use SSH to log into my server over here. Who knows, you know, what kind of vulnerabilities were introduced. I guess there's nothing to say about it.
The XZ repo is disabled on GitHub.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, the only solution at this point is not to get an updated XZ, but to get a downgraded XZ, to roll back to, I think, 5.6.1. I can't remember what the version is. But in almost every case, your distribution of Linux or your homebrew or Mac ports or whatever you're using, people are aware of this and are backpatching in almost every case. I immediately ran Homebrew Update when I read about this, and it fixed it. But I didn't know I had that on there. I didn't use XZ. I never even heard of it, but it was on there.
I'm not sure if it. I mean, that's not the default either, which is why I'm curious to why it would be as severe of a problem. Maybe it passes through XZ if you're trying to have a failed login attempt. Maybe it's like, oh, maybe it's using.
I don't know.
I don't know. It's weird.
It's used in libllzma. So it may be a library that was. This is the problem, though, is libraries that use libraries. You don't know where this. There's so much code in everything we use. And this is true also of proprietary software that you buy off the shelf. It's using open source, almost always using some sort of open source libraries. And you just don't know because you aren't. It's not your responsibility. And of course, nation state actors are very motivated to do this. And they're probably, truth is, they're not attacking me or you, probably. They're going to use this in some, discerning ways to attack Alan. And
me?
Former NSA officer might have some stuff on his hard drive. We don't know. He's got a lot of storage.
No, here's the funny thing. It's because of what I used to do that if some country A was trying to use this on country B, the NSA people are the ones that would probably catch that and then try to put out advisories.
The thing is so cool about the NSA is that really they have two missions. One is to
said
keep
nobody
us.
Ever.
No, I no. Listen, one is to keep us secure, right? The NSA has some excellent documentation on how to harden your system on Windows or Mac or Linux. They have lots of great stuff. But then their other job is to completely crack all the software and they make us insecure. And I don't know if it's two people or one person with two heads. I don't know how they do it. But they have two missions, really, right? Am I wrong, Alan?
Well, it's part of national defense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's defense.
Which does sometimes include offense, depending.
But I think you can trust the NSA cybersecurity recommendations. They seem very good and very sophisticated, right?
Oh, listen. Part of my day to day when I was there was reverse engineering malware that countries were using against each other. Like we would catch other foreign countries that we were allowed to snoop on because they're not, United States. People, right? We would catch something go across the wire and go, ooh, that's a nasty piece of malware. Okay. And I would pick it apart. And then part of my job description was to come up with even like going as far as to come up with an antivirus signature or a signature for catching that thing going across the wire that you could put on a network sensor. In other words, to prevent it from, if that country then decides to attack the United States, we would be protected, right?
Here's a very important piece I would suggest everybody read on UEFI secure boot customization from the NSA last March. Things you need to do. This is what they do, and it's great. But I guess it's a side effect of the real job, right?
Well, hey, there's a Ghidra. There's like the NSA makes really good.
Ghidra is very cool. Yes, that's right? Amazing. It's a disassembler that's brilliant, right? It's the best disassembler out there. Yeah.
And they're doing it. I mean, they're doing it for themselves first, but then because they're publicly funded, they're kind of obligated to open source the thing.
Software reverse engineering suite developed by NSA's Research Directorate.
Yeah. And I mean, that's born out of necessity.
Right.
That exists because they needed better tools to be able to reverse engineer things.
Right. Very interesting.
Unfortunately for me, it was only coming about when I was doing that job. So I had to use all of the other tools and not the fancy new one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
They do have a GitHub a page with a few tools on here that you can open source and download.
That's a really powerful set of tools. You can get an ISO that's like a bootable environment that's just a git drill, like reverse engineering.
I like it that one of the languages that they use is called Groovy. See, I think in Good Will Hunting, he should have joined the NSA. I think he should have. He would have enjoyed using Groovy. They use it for Skill Tree, a micro-learning gamification platform for skills stress tests. I want to learn Groovy just for the name. All right, let's anyway, I didn't mean to scare everybody, but I think it's really important we talk about this and people be aware of it. And probably there is no issue with Windows, I'm guessing. Nobody in Windows is using XZ.
Unless you're using
WSL. WSL. Yeah. Yep. That's a good point. Good point. More to come in just a bit. First, a word from our fine sponsor for this half hour, stamps.com. Did I say this half hour? For more than a decade, since 2012, they've been a sponsor of Twit. We love stamps.com. And frankly, we've been using it since before then. It's every office should have stamps.com. It streamlines all your mailing, all your shipping. Man, if you're an Etsy or eBay seller or an Amazon seller and you're not using stamps.com, I guarantee you, you're not looking as professional. You're not making it as easy as you could. It will turbocharge your operational efficiencies. It's like a post office in your pocket. You can stay on top of things even on the go. We've been using them since the last decade. They've been a sponsor since 2012. And I know you've heard me talk about them. So what are you waiting for? We've got a fantastic offer for you. And one of the things I like about stamps.com, whenever I need just plain old postage stamps, I go to Debbie. I say, print me some postage stamps. She prints them out for me. We get the little Avery labels, so they print out, and they're just like the – I don't have to go to the post office. That's the whole point of stamps.com. You know, postage rates just went up again. It's a really great time to get stamps.com. They've got the best discounts in the industry, discounts you can't even get at the post office. Up to 89% off United States Postal Service. And now that Stamps.com does UPS as well, United Parcel Service as well, you get great discounts there too. And what's cool is because they do both, they will automatically tell you your cheapest and fastest shipping options. So you know if you're doing it the best way possible. All you need a computer and you need a printer. Not a special printer, not a postage meter, just your regular everyday printer. And we're going to send you a USB scale that'll even do the weighing, so you always have exactly the right postage and exactly the right kind of mail or UPS. And if you need a package pickup, you can schedule it right through the dashboard. Keep your mailing and shipping moving at the speed of your business with stamps.com. It is really the way to go. Sign up with the promo code TWIT right now. We got a very good offer. 4-week trial, free postage, plus a free digital scale I mentioned. With no long-term commitments, no contracts, you just go to stamps.com, click the microphone right at the top of the page, and enter the code TWIT, TWIT. It's a very nice offer. Stamps.com. You've heard me talk about them. Why are you waiting? Don't wait anymore. Stamps.com. Last week we spent a lot of time talking about Apple versus the DOJ. Not much more to say about that. In fact, this is going to be one of those things that's going to go on for years. You must have covered the Microsoft DOJ stuff in the 90s, right, Daniel?
Oh, no, that was before my time.
It was before your time? Oh, it wasn't before mine. Yeah. It just went on and on. I remember it very well.
Yeah.
But even in the DOJ lawsuit against Apple, they said, you know, our lawsuit against Microsoft made it all possible for Apple. They pat themselves a little bit on the back, which is anatomically difficult for making it easier for Apple. And I guess to some degree, that's true. The Microsoft pre this was pretty aggressive is probably the best way to put it.
And I think we all agree too, like, you know, the idea of like splitting Microsoft apart and all this kind of stuff is a good thing it didn't happen.
Yes.
Like what they came to as a solution, I think long-term was good for the industry. It was good for Microsoft. And it's probably the way things should go, which is the idea of a compromise, right, between the government and these large and increasingly large firms.
Yeah. I feel like I seem to remember the DOJ did want to break them up. And I remember Dvorak and others saying, you know what? from the point of view of Microsoft shareholders, this wouldn't be a bad thing. We'd get four new stocks that would immediately go up. We'd be making money. Yeah. It's not a bad thing. But I think it, in the long run, what the DOJ did was probably the right thing. And I don't know what their goals are with Apple. They haven't been as clear with Apple about what they want. But I imagine it'll be some of the same things. They're not going to break Apple up, but they might want Apple to open up their app store, for instance, just as the EU does. Things like that. Anyway,
it's interesting to see like how long it took to get to this part, right? Because like these complaints have been going on for a long time, whether it's their iMessage and the store, of course, the way both Apple and Google, played hard against Microsoft for the smartphone, wars back then. Google famously, it's a good question, right? Google never provided apps for Microsoft for their store. And then when Microsoft made a YouTube app that was compliant with Google's own terms.
I remember that.
Google still blocked it.
Right.
It was like there was no world in which Google was going to allow Microsoft to have any kind of official Google app on its phone platform. And no one really got upset about that. That was just seen as like, well, that's just tough, but now it's drove. I just read a story about like there's over 500 phone makers that were driven out of the smartphone industry over the last couple of years. And it's just because, you have Samsung, of course, who's doing really well. You have Google and then you have Apple. And they just they really pushed everyone out. And I don't know. It's an interesting debate whether it's fair.
That's in the DOJ complaint against Apple. They said Amazon Fire Phone failed because the Apple iPhone owned the market, which is a little bit of a stretch.
Yes, big stretch.
They mentioned HTC and LG getting out of the smartphone market, and they blamed Apple on that.
Here's a hilarious double-edged sword on this entire situation. We just got finished covering XZ, and if everybody and their mama could make a phone instead of a handful of people who you know exactly who to yell at when something goes awry.
That is a good point.
Now we have to yell at 187 people to try to figure out who screwed up. Right now, we have one of four people to slap, and we pretty much got it covered. And a lot of people don't. To me, for this, the ubiquitous nature of phones, and I would say how much of person's digital life inside the kimono is on the phone, having more options of phones to me is making it less secure. And I'm really curious where Alan says about it because he's much smarter than me. This is just my feelings of the situation.
Alan, do you use an Android or an iPhone?
I use an iPhone, but mostly out of force of habit.
That's probably the case for most people, right? It's just it's the default.
Yeah, and for me, it's not even so much because I'm locked into the ecosystem because that's the only thing. I don't use Macs. I only recently started using the watch, like not for very long. And honestly, I don't use much of the integrated functionality on the watch either. In that case, so
you need Stepdog. It's a little doggy. No, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's just I got somebody was at. Like jailbreak their iPhone, like they had not. This is way back in like the GD time frame, and a friend of mine from work was like, "Hey, I got T-Mobile, but I want to make this iPhone work on it. Can you fix that for me?"
It was singular and only in the early days. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And they said, "If you fix that for me, like, oh, I have an original iPhone. I'll give you that."
Wow.
And so I just got one for free and was like, "Oh, okay." And at the time, I was on Windows Mobile, whatever, on like a HTC something or another. Right, I think I had the HTC flip keyboard style thing.
You're not going to back then. You're not going to like this. The box first generation iPhone in the shrink wrap sold for $190,000.
Yeah,
last year.
Yeah, this one was not brand new in box.
Oh, okay, all right. So you didn't lose anything.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it was his older one that he had, paid whatever the ridiculous
when the iPhone first came out.
Was.
I was going to Canada to do a call for help in Canada, and I brought Amber MacArthur. I jailbroke an original iPhone for her because you couldn't use it in Canada, and I jailbroke it and brought it up to her and said, "You can use it." She never used it. She didn't trust me. I think she didn't trust me, honestly. She thought, yeah, Leo.
That's probably one of the best things about Apple and the iPhone was that they really sort of broke up the carrier domination over the smartphone.
Right.
You know, that was like one thing I thought was really brilliant, that they, you know, forced the carriers to, you know, let them do updates directly. Now that's a common thing, because it used to be so frustrating how bad carriers held back innovation.
They were the worst.
So
we forget that. Yeah, they would push both Google and Apple would push updates, and the carriers would just say no.
Yeah,
because it cost them. They didn't want to. They didn't want to waste the bandwidth, and they said.
Well,
no.
The other thing that they helped
in the
break
testing.
Up, along with with John, they helped break up the. You were paying basically about $2,800 for an $800 phone if you let yourself live in contract life. If you didn't have the ability to just buy a phone and you were to hold it for 2 years, you'd be almost $3,000 into an $800 phone. And so they helped sort of break that up as well.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing, which is really funny, is the catalyst to the majority of this hassle right now has to deal with Epic. And all of us OG gamers remember games that came out fully functional and you just played them. And then companies like Epic and EA deliver betas that you have to pay in order to be good at.
For the 40 gigabyte download and the loot box. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So now you have to buy, you know, Smurf berries or whatever the currency is in that particular game.
I blame Apple for Smurf berries. I do.
Right. Was it Wii Farm? I think what was the Zynga one? Not Wii Farm.
Where it was Reroll, there was Farmville.
Farmville.
There you go. That started it. Buying the in-app, let me get something because I don't want to know how to play. I got extra money, so let me just buy this and make my farm domination.
I have still a credit for 300 Simpsons tapped out donuts that I have not used. I want my donuts. I think Apple created freemium, didn't they? I mean, that... Not intentionally.
Well, companies created it because they realized they can make grip on it, even with Apple's taking their percentage.
Right.
And you remember that first keynote where they're like, we've paid out over $5 billion to developers.
Which means we kept 30% of that.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I'm blaming freemium on the iPhone. Why am I? I feel like there was a reason for that, the business model. It could have been the 30%. I felt like that Apple encouraged free apps. Oh, I know why. Because there was no demo, right?
That's
on Android. You could try it for a week or whatever. There'd be demo versions, but on Apple there was no demo versions. So developers said, we've got to get people using our apps without actually charging them $5.99 up front, and that really prompted, I think. I don't think freemium would have taken off except for that. And at that point, you're getting the app for free. You can play it for free. And oh, by the way, you need Zynga berries. And it was a little easier. In fact, Apple got in a lot of trouble. Remember, there was a parent whose kid was playing, one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish or something. And the kid kept going to mama, can I get some blue fish? More, I need more fish. And the mama would say, yeah, and press the button. And she got like a $500 bill. And she said, what the hell? And that's when Apple changed the in-app purchase deal. And you had to get parental permission to do that. So they tried. But I think as a result, I think freemium took
off. I think I would feel better if I felt they knew exactly what they wanted. I'm talking about the government here. If they knew exactly what they wanted, I would feel better. And if they just weren't so clueless about the simplest things, and it's funny, then they realize that the tech companies are doing all this and they're making the money, right? And this has been going on for roughly 10 years that they've been complaining to the tech companies. You know what they haven't done in that entire time? Increase the educational spending for STEM programs that would make more people in the country more tech savvy. They haven't done something like, I'll give you a tax deduction if you go take some basic cybersecurity classes and things so that you as a citizen are better aware so you don't become a victim of these things. Like, there's so many things that they could do in order to make us catch back
up. Is that their responsibility, right? Though, really?
I mean, I would say no, except for having gone to school in Japan, and Japan does things like this, right? When their economy was trying to get back on track, one of the things they did was they incentivized learning to get back into the crafts, bringing back the handcrafts, bringing back the things that we all traveled to Japan for. They incentivized holding together certain longstanding traditions. And yeah, so maybe it's not their responsibility, but if you want to get good quick, how about make it, instead of making us take, I don't know, advanced stretching in PE, maybe make people learn more about computing. I don't know.
I think you could do both. More PE.
I think you could do both as well.
And,
I agree.
And STEM.
I think we need more PE.
And let's throw some music and art in as well. Let's do it all.
We were just talking about home ec. Like, we had home ec, and we had to do the family planning thing where you carried around either the egg in some schools.
Oh,
and
I remember that.
Actual
little baby.
Plastic baby and others. But then, you know, the let's say religious zealot people of the U.S. was like, nope, you got to stop that. You're teaching kids to.
That's why they don't do that anymore?
Yeah.
How many kids do you have after carrying around that egg?
None.
It's great birth control, isn't it?
100%. I knew right away. That was my, 12th grade? Nope. Not your man's. I'm going to stay suited. Not me. Not going down like that. I like cameras and computers, and they're expensive, so therefore, no bottles.
Where did you go to school?
At that particular time in Rockville, Maryland. Right outside of
Did Mexico. You have driver's training?
Yes, with a simulator.
Oh, wow. Pretty fancy. We had driver's training in an automobile on Highway 1 from Santa Cruz and on a two-lane road where you had to... And they said, okay, now, there's four of us in the car. All he has on his side is a brake pedal. Not a steering wheel, just a brake pedal. He says, okay, Leo, pass. That's the first time in a car, and he wants me on a two-lane, full-speed highway, pass. I did it, but that was the most terrifying experience. However, they took that. We don't have driver's training anymore in California.
Nope.
You have to go to a private school if you want to do that, or a parent has to teach the kid.
And you know what made us learn to drive good? The simulator and Ralph Nader films.
They showed off. Well, they did bring us this. They did the Highway Patrol has a famous film, which is basically a bunch of mangled cars and bodies that they show you. I remember that true.
Yes. I was terrified to drink a soda and drive because of the drunk driving videos they show us. I'm like, what if the caffeine makes my hands shaky? Like, I was horrible when I first started.
We're old timers now, Doc. So this week, EU did push also their Digital Markets Act, the kind of the other shoe dropped. They are now probing, and it's never fun to be probed, Apple, Meta, and Alphabet. The first full investigations under the Digital Markets Act. Found guilty of noncompliance, companies could face fines as much as 10% of revenue, global revenue. That's billions of dollars. The commission said it was concerned that Apple and Alphabet had imposed restrictions and limitations that constrained developers' ability to promote other services. That's the App Store. You can't mention, for instance, if you're Amazon, that, oh, by the way, you could buy this book on the Amazon website, let alone on the app. It added it was looking at services including Google Shopping and Google Flights over whether Google was giving preference to its own companies and its search results. That's an old complaint, which I think is not – that's not the problem with Google, really. There's other problems with Google, but I don't think – promoting Google Shopping, which does it even exist anymore? The commission is looking whether Apple was meeting its obligations to allow users to easily uninstall any software applications.
Yeah, they've gotten better with that. Those are the inbox apps.
Yeah, but most
Microsoft's
of those you
gotta
do
that
install.
Too. Yeah. Yeah, I think they're pretty good now. So and I think the bigger thing is the store stuff.
I think it's the store, yeah. But they do mention Apple's restrictions on changing default settings browsers and search engines.
Yes.
Now, Apple
doesn't stick till you till you reset the phone, you reboot the phone.
Right. They allow you to temporary. Do it, but only temporarily. Yeah.
And then for certain things, it won't, like if you switch the keyboard on an iPhone, 90% of the time it works.
Right.
But then like on certain forms, it goes back to the Apple and they don't trust it. You know,
I gave up.
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
I gave up. I'm just using Apple's keyboard because it always works. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a bug. Is that it? The commission opened proceedings against Meta over whether the group's new... Oh, this is something Meta introduced in the EU. Pay or consent. So Meta said, okay, since you won't let us spy on our users, collect data for advertising, we'll offer an option. You could either consent to being, giving up information to advertisers, or pay us money for the subscription. But the EU said, we don't think that's exactly what we meant.
That's a weird complaint, that one. Just because, I mean, I understand where they're coming from. They're saying, you know, a subscription fee. But this goes back to the origins of the internet, the problem where everybody decided to give everything away for free.
And it's not free. It's not free for these companies. It costs them a lot of money. And they knew they were going to have to make money at some point, but they certainly conditioned us to expecting it to be for free.
Right. Yeah. This is a deep conversation for us right now, Leo, because as you know, in my place of business, there was a Facebook developer put out a situation maybe like mid-February that says on April 22nd, basically coming up, they're canceling all third-party API access to the ability to stream into groups. And of course, some moguls got a hold of it and freaked out because they do these massive, like, paid groups, right? So say you're in, you know, Alan's SSD lovers group, and he does webinars and seminars in there. And, you know, a lot of people make money through their products that they sell by running these seminars in their Facebook groups. Well, all of a sudden, they're like, well, you're no longer going to be able to stream to your group with the third-party tool. You can still do it if you know how to write RTMP, you know, key and URL, which is super simple. But everyone's freaking out that Facebook is closing their business down. And it's like, but, you know, to run video services is expensive. And in order to allow you to distribute your program through your Facebook group to 200,000 users, there's a heavy cost to it. Oh, no, it's free. No, it's not. Facebook's paying it right now. And the way they're covering that cost is stealing your data. But if they're going to be now told that they no longer can steal your data, especially since half of your users are in the EU, then this is why they're stopping it. And people can't understand that. So they immediately called us and they're blaming us. They're like, oh,
yeah, you had Ecamm had to put out something. a whole blog post.
Like, no, he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have workarounds in the blog post. Katie put a blog post up explaining what it means and how you can get around it. I wasn't even aware.
But to Daniel's point, people don't understand that none of this is free. Even Gmail is not free. Those servers, if you ever had to buy your own server, you would know this. They don't come. That stuff is not cheap, right? Or the space. Ooh, look, I'm running out of, 200 gigs. 200 gig drives aren't free.
Right. And, you know, in Katie's blog post on Ecamm, she said, well, you can still use Discord or Zoom or, you know, the other places to do it. But how long are those going to be free?
Right. Right. Eventually, if it's not costing you something, it's your info. And most people still can't grok that.
Yeah, I think people do want it for free. And they want privacy. It's kind of why, I mean, I have podcasts are also hit by this. And, you know, I would love to continue. We are free, ad supported free. And I would think that's a great way to do it. It's democratic. Anybody can watch or listen that wants to. And all we do is, you know, and we don't spy on people. We can't, cause it's an RSS feed. We don't know anything about you. And that's kind of a problem because companies like Spotify and others that get you to download their app to listen to the podcast do know everything about you. And so they offer to advertisers, they say to advertisers, you know, you could buy a podcast and just hope that your ads are working, or you could buy it on Spotify and we'll tell you exactly what you're buying and whether it's working and whether they heard it and whether they bought and so forth. And it's very hard to compete. It's hurt us. It's hurt us badly. It's hurt most independent podcasts very badly. And it's making the idea of an RSS-based, you know, the traditional podcast medium shaky, a lot shakier.
Oh, you would have loved Kai Chuck's talk about YouTube dipping into the podcast space, because I've been preaching this for 2 years, right? And I knew they were going to do it because our friend Renee works over there. And, you know, I was always just kind of guessing from listening to what he says. But the one thing you know about podcasts on YouTube, a stream or a view is an accurate measure. Whereas downloads, we had these automatically things landing into your podcast app. Some of us have four or five podcast apps on the same phone, right? So you could be getting five or six downloads to Alan's podcast, but maybe I didn't listen to any of them because I've been busy.
Don't say that out loud. We don't want advertisers to know that.
I think they figured it out now. So Kai is like, we're going to kick butt because our stats, our analytics are exactly correct.
This is a podcast movement you were talking about.
Yeah.
I question that. I think YouTube inflates the numbers dramatically.
I agree with you too.
100%. I don't. And this is the problem with numbers. And podcasters did this to themselves too, because many podcasters would inflate their numbers in public. We never did, but they would kind of lie. Or, as you say, there was a lot of upset in the podcast world when Apple's podcasts stopped automatically downloading shows if you stopped listening to them. If you haven't listened in 3 weeks, we're not going to download any more shows. And that killed the numbers for so many podcasts. But my attitude is, well, people weren't listening, so it should kill the numbers. It's okay.
Correct.
You're telling an advertiser that there's a download, but it's not a listen.
I can't believe I'm going to say this. Don't tell her I said this. The most brilliant person I've ever talked to about this is somebody named Lisa Laporte. She knows everything.
Well, she's where the rubber hits the road. And
that's
probably not what I should say.
Oh, my God. My head was exploding with what she knows. Don't tell her I said something that nice about her. But she is brilliant. I was enthralled. I was enthralled because she knows every
system. We understand, though, because we're doing it. We understand what the hazards are. That's why, frankly, she decided to start the club 2 years ago. We needed to make up for the loss of advertising revenue, because we can't and we don't want to track our listeners. We just really don't want to do that. The agencies want us to, by the way. I've mentioned this before. Big agency came to us and said, okay, here, you got to add this tracking pixel to all your downloads. And we said, no, we lost a number of advertisers because of it. All the advertisers that they brought us, they said, well, we're not going to buy your podcast. We said, sorry, but thing is, it's partly, you know, from integrity, but it's also partly because our audience is smart and they block those. And as soon as we put trackers in the downloads, people, they can't download them because they're all running ad blockers. And their pie holes and their stuff just blocks it. And then we get all these complaints. Well, I can't, your show won't download anymore. Well, yeah. So I honestly, it's a tricky one. Daniel, you have podcasts, right? On Windows Central.
Yeah. And we do, just like everybody else, like certain ads, stuff like that. But future as a company overall is not like bullish on podcast at the moment.
Yeah, that's sad. I mean, it could be, it should be, but it's because it's for you promotional only, because there's not a lot of revenue in it. And is it a good promotional vehicle? I don't know.
Right? Yeah, we do ours not as a business, right? Ours is just an extension, and we do it very unproduced. Right. Let's just say that,
which is fine.
But like a lot of podcasts go into like real production. They do like preparation, a lot of research, you know, and so they become this like sub business, you know, and then it becomes harder to support. So it's like some people do it one way, some people do it the other way. And the fact is, like, at least for us, like, as cool as Windows is,
it's just not worth
apparently
it.
Not as it's no murder mystery, right? So it's like we don't get the same audience.
But to me, that's, you know, problematic. That's what happened in blogging, and it was sad. Blogging basically bisected into a very small number of blogs like Windows Central that can make money. And then almost everybody else is either doing it out of fun, for fun, because they're not going to make any money out of it, or because it promotes a product. But in a way, that's too bad, because you're losing voices that, whether it's in blogging or podcasting, that I think are great. And people love, by the way, I just saw a stat. I'm sure they talked about this podcast movement. I don't know if it was Edison. 47% of Americans listen to a podcast at least once a month. 47%. That's what's weird. It's this growing business industry. It's this growing medium, much more so than radio. But it's the same time where it's hard, very hard for us to support ourselves. It's a weird situation.
Yeah, you know what's cool to Daniel's point, though? One of the things I love the most about podcasting is, like, Daniel's podcast could be, like, slam poetry at the coffee shop, whereas, like, you know, something on the Twit Network is, like, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream at the amphitheater in Sydney, right? And,
thank you for that comparison, I think.
But having that duality, to me, is where the dope stuff is, right? As a kid who has both just spit rhymes in front of the bodega on the corner, but I've also done it in front of a packed house at Neil Blaisdell Center with 10,000 people.
Wow.
And they both feel good. And they're two different, you know, two different vibes, right? And I enjoy both. So I think I tell my students all the time, I like the content where you just be you and you're not trying to be, you know, Edward R. Murrow. Today I'm presenting the news. Like, you know, somebody just needs to see somebody like you, because I feel like you're ascertainable, or we're on the same level. Whereas sometimes when you're looking at, you know, something that's overly produced, you're always looking up and you feel like they might understand me, but they don't necessarily get me. So I think there's space for both. But to Leo's point, the industry is getting a little split by the haves and have nots at this point, and hopefully there's a way to mellow that out.
So to get back to the original point, it's reasonable for Meta to say in the EU, $14.99 a month and you can have Meta, or you're going to have to give us information so we can sell ads. It's either or. That's the cost of doing business. And I don't think that's an unreasonable thing. So I agree with you. I don't think the EU is right on that particular thing.
It is weird with the stores, though, because I run into that all the time. I'll be like on my Kindle, reading a sample, which I love.
So frustrating.
Just download the sample.
Yeah.
But then it's like, oh, I want to go buy this book. Nope. Hop on my phone because it's faster.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, you can't through our app. You have to go use a PC to just hit one button.
And by the way, we can't even tell you where you could go. We can't even say anything about it. That's really draconian on Apple's part.
It's such a weird experience to do that.
Yeah. Speaking of podcasts, by the way, Google is shutting down its Google Podcasts next week.
That was on purpose.
The Google
that
give
was to
us
get you to go to YouTube,
and the Google taketh away. Okay, that's to get. See, but when I go to YouTube podcasts, it's a little sensationalistic. You know,
it's
what I'm
still
saying?
In beta. They know they have a long way to go, but one of the things that they had to do in order to close the hole was merge the teams.
It so looks like Google National podcasts Enquirer, but that's this is my problem with YouTube in general, which is that in fact it's hysterical. Mr. Beast is saying, "Stop shouting and talking fast and making loud noises," which was the path he had to success on YouTube. But now everybody's copying him, and he's saying, "No, we shouldn't do this anymore. Let's slow down and be quiet." Yeah, right. YouTube promotes sensationalism.
Hyper edit.
Yeah, the hyper edit is
deleterious to kids and attention span. So now everybody's like, let's back off of hyper edit. I'm like, bro, you started it. Okay. We never did that. You started it. Right. And now it's gone crazy.
Yeah. They call it the Mr. Beastification.
It is funny with the trends, though, right? There is, as you know, Doc Rock was talking about, like, there is this trend now, I think, on YouTube where people are trying to go back to the more roots, almost like a vlogging type approach, where you're not going to this overproduced.
It'll never work because they won't. The people who will get all the hits are going to be the people who are going, she's a cheater. You know, I mean, it's that's human nature, right? That's human nature. So YouTube promotes basically, whether it's on video or their podcasts, this kind of sensationalism. And it's not YouTube's fault. They're just they're giving people what they want.
Yep. Emotion. I definitely hate versus content, you know, like, Apple Watch versus the Galaxy Watch. I don't like that because they both deserve to stand on their own. And they have things that are cool. Not everything needs to be a competition, but that stuff rocks. I just opened up YouTube right now, and there's about 5 versus videos on the first page.
Yeah.
I'm like, I hate that content. Yeah. I really hate it.
I love the thumbnails. The thumbnails crack me up now. Everybody's like, whoa, you know, like doing the
But it's not YouTube's. Is it YouTube's fault? I mean, is YouTube, should YouTube say, oh, no, we're going to not promote that stuff anymore, even though that's what you want?
Well, I mean, it goes into the next story, right? Daniel Kahneman there. But the idea of behavior in economics and, you know, what people click on and like what people view. The fact is, it's like the algorithm is tuned to human behavior.
Right.
And so
it's us.
All YouTubers are doing is just like, they're responding to that. And like there's it, that trend now to you do a thumbnail and then you wait a couple hours, see how it does. And if it doesn't work, you switch out the thumbnail to something else.
Mr. Beast did that too. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, okay, let's talk about that. We're going to take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about Kahneman, but we'll also talk about Jonathan Haidt's new book that says, think of the children that social media is creating a mental illness epidemic. Which on the face of it seems reasonable, but maybe not in fact. But before we do that, I think we should talk about Eufy. Where's my Eufy? Could you give me my Eufy? Our show today brought to you by the Eufy Video Smart Lock. Now, you know the name Eufy. We say Anchor all the time. We love Anchor products. Anchor created the Eufy brand and the Soundcore brand. And this is a new Eufy device that I think is super cool. In fact, we installed one here in the studio. This is their video smart lock. It combines a video doorbell, there's the camera, with a lock and a fingerprint reader, too, so you can unlock the door with your fingerprint. We shot a video of Micah did this with a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling. It's got 0.3-second fingerprint recognition. It's got 1-second unlocking. The embedded AI self-learning chip becomes more accurate with every use. But here's what I really love about Eufy. Unlike all those other smart locks and smart doorbells you look at, there's no subscription. There's no monthly fee. And they don't upload your videos to the cloud. It's private and you don't pay a monthly fee. This comes with a 10,000 milliamp rechargeable battery, which is about 4 months of use. You'll get a low battery notification should it get low. But here's the best part. It works with a key as well. I would not get one of these automatic door openers, unlocks, unless I had one that works with a key. And it does. You'll see in the video. You can just pull out the knob there and put in your key, and it still works even with zero power. You can also use it to control your front door remotely using the Eufy Video Lock app, which means you've got passcode unlocking, remote control, 2K clear sight, two-way audio. It's got great night vision. We put this on the server room door because we wanted improved security on the server room. What a great idea. Just fantastic. And no monthly fees. Your Eufy Video Lock recordings are stored locally. You never have to pay for storage. 18-month warranty. It's all backed by Eufy's 24/7 professional customer service team. And you know, we love the products that Anchor and Eufy come up with. And this is one of the best. Just came out, the Eufy Video Lock. Easy to find out more. Search for Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y, E-U-F-Y, on Amazon or visit EUFY.com. There's a lot of great products there. This is part of their new home line that I think is fantastic. Eufy, EUFY.com. Or just go to Amazon. They told us, I said, well, if people go and buy it on Amazon, do we get credit? And they said, yeah, we're keeping track of who searches for Eufy Video Lock. So that's good. Eufy Video Lock on Amazon. I have to say, I love our advertisers, including, by the way, Doc Rock Ecamm, because they don't say, oh, we're going to track you. We got to, they just trust that we have a smart audience that knows what it's doing, and when they hear about a good product, they're going to go for it. And boy, I'm very grateful that there are still advertisers like that that say, they don't say, well, The Eufy Video Lock, you're going to love it. You can install it yourself. Very nice. Search for Eufy Video Lock on Amazon or go to EUFY.com. Local security, no monthly fee. I love them. Thank you, Eufy. Thank you very much for your support of This Week in Tech. I'll do the Daniel Kahneman first, but that'll lead us into this new book by Jonathan Haidt. Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner for economics, wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow. Has anybody read it?
Yes.
Good book, huh?
Yes.
Fascinating.
I love all of his stuff.
Yeah. He's a Princeton professor. He was a psychologist, I think, but got a Nobel Prize in economics in 2002. Passed away this week at the age of 90. His greatest work still is Thinking Fast and Slow, in which he kind of reveals something that, if you think about it, makes perfect sense, that we have two thinking systems. He called them System 1 and 2, but it's actually intuition and logic, right? And we think logic drives what we're doing. In fact, most of the time it's intuition or just a gut feel, right? My emotional sense. And then we use logic to say, oh, well, this is why I felt that way. It usually starts. But he also came up with all sorts of, I love the idea of loss aversion. It's much worse to lose $100 than it is to gain $100. So, which is why people who constantly watch their stock portfolio overdo the buying and selling, because the pain of losing outweighs the pleasure of gaining. So they're kind of overweighting their losses. It's also, according to the New York Times, why golfers have been found to putt better when going for par on a given hole than for a stroke gaining birdie. They try harder on a par putt because they want to avoid the bogey. Now, I know I don't play golf, but that I understand that in many other contexts. There was a good discussion about this on Hacker News, though, in which many people pointed out that a lot of Kahneman's assertions have actually not been replicated. Let me see if I can find it, Benito, before you show it. Have not been replicated in science. That he's quoting studies that are one-offs, basically. And I think that's kind of part of the problem of a lot of this kind of stuff, is it plays to your intuition, but it doesn't really hold up in terms of logic, which is kind of interesting. My friend Cory Doctorow calls this just-so stories, and he includes Malcolm Gladwell in this group of people who tell stories that make a lot of sense, like the cracked window problem in cities.
Crime.
Right. Yeah. If you fix the little things and it reduces crime, there's no statistical evidence to support that. And this is the problem, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely a fine line between what he's saying and, you know, being able to replicate studies, but also this idea of like decision making. And, you know, I do err on the side of the fact that humans are really bad at decision making.
I think that's accurate.
This also gets, yeah.
Yeah.
And there are these biases in place. You know, I think last time I was here, I was mentioning about Robert Sapolsky's new book, Determined, which goes into this whole thing about free will. And he cites a lot of this kind of research, which is that, you know, we think we're making these decisions, whether on economics or anything in our life, but it's all the moments leading up to this moment that's going to influence your decision. So this idea that you're really making a choice isn't there, because it's based completely on your previous experiences. And, you know, I think that type of research is super important. And just in general economics, you know, I was a political science major in college, but I did economics too. And they called it the dismal science for a reason. It was completely abstracted away from human behavior. It was just mathematics and formulas and assumptions. But this idea of like the rational actor was just ridiculous. I think anyone who knew people realize people are not rational. Right. Like, they don't make decisions.
Oh, economicus, you know, is really not thinking. Yeah, he's not.
Right. And everything from your hormones at that very moment to whether you just ate, like, affects decision-making. It's, there's so many variables in place that, you know, for economics to completely ignore that was ridiculous. So I applaud the idea of, like, bringing this into behavioral sciences. At least makes it a little bit more tangible.
And these are wonderful books to read. Freakonomics, fantastic story. Kahneman himself said the book would have been different had it been written later. For instance, in particularly in chapter 4 on priming, it turned out, and Kahneman acknowledged it later, that the implicit priming literature is not trustworthy and not based in empirical research. And so read it, but. And it's fascinating, and a lot of it will resound with truth. That's part of the problem, though. That's more of the same, where it feels true, so we believe it. It's kind of more of the same. So I agree. And the reason I bring this up is Jonathan Haidt's book, which I'm sad to say a lot of people are kind of quoting and supporting. I'm seeing a lot of conversation on Twitter about it. And I think it's important to point out that it may not be all he says it is. They call it the great rewiring. Is social, this is an article from Nature that came out this week. Is social media really behind an epidemic of teenage mental illness? Jonathan Haidt says it is in his new book, The Anxious Generation, how the great rewiring of childhood is causing an epidemic of mental illness. And it kind of makes sense to us that, you know, a generation raised staring at their phone on TikTok or Snapchat or Instagram is not interacting with the real world. And maybe that's why there are, you know, great increases in the suicide rate and mental health issues. This article in Nature says there is absolutely no evidence that this is the case. It's one of those things that sounds right and feels good, but in fact is not the case. The article.
And oh my God, I love this article. I love this conversation.
It's Candace Odgers writing. Let me just quote what she says. Then she says, hundreds of researchers, myself included, have searched for the kind of large effects suggested by Haidt. Our efforts have produced a mix of no, small, and mixed associations. Most data are correlative. When associations over time are found, they suggest not that social media use predicts or causes depression, but that young people who already have mental health problems use such platforms more often or in different ways from healthy peers. These are not just our data or my opinion. Several meta-analyses and systematic reviews converge on the same message. An analysis, for instance, done in 72 countries shows no consistent or measurable associations between well-being and the rollout of social media globally. Findings from the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, the largest long-term study of adolescent brain development in the U.S., found zero evidence of drastic changes associated with digital technology use. So, the problem is people are reading Haidt's book and legislators are proposing we ban TikTok or we, as is in Florida, require parental consent for people under 16 to use social media. They respond to it with laws. What do you think?
It doesn't
work.
What do
you think, Doc?
It doesn't work. First of all, listen, I don't know about you, but I remember the red cup parties that I made so much money in high school throwing.
You mean those solo cups? No, what's a red cup party?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we used to sell these solo cup at the locker room on Friday for $5, right? If you brought the solo cup to the barn that we were going to put this party in, that was your admission, and then you could fill it up as many times as you could on the kegs, right? None of us were old enough to drink. Nobody could go to the liquor store and buy liquor, but most kids in high school work at restaurants in order to make money. So what would happen? One of the kegs might end up in the back of the restaurant and might end up in the barn on a Friday when your mans was DJing. I'm just saying, you can't stop kids from doing what they want to do. Let's start there. But the reason why this chaps my nads is all the way back when we first got printed books, it was like, you can't read those because those are going to make your brain crazy, right? Because people who were getting educated was now able to argue back with the oppression, right? And then it went to magazines, and then it went to radio, and then it went to TV, and then it's video games, and then it's like, well, color TV, and then it's like, well, let in all of us hang out in the same room because we're from all different cultures, and now it's social media. Listen, if anything, all of the positives of a, let's say, disambiguated education system far outweigh the less. But what we do know now is that we understand mental health a little better, which we didn't in the past. So it's always existed. It was just hidden in the various things. Now that we understand mental health better, we also have the situation where people are modeling symptoms that they don't necessarily have. I have huge fights with people in my creator community about creator burnout. I was like, bro, I never heard you once utter the word imposter syndrome or creator burnout, but because they got popular in the last 5 years, now everybody has it. I'm like, Paula Rosecrans wrote that paper eons ago and nobody knew about it. And then Oprah brought it up one day and everybody has imposter syndrome all of a sudden. It's like watching the ad for Leotonian 2.0 talk to your doctor. And it may cause like shaky legs and irritable bowels. And
I
then
get every one
bowels.
Of those. I see those and I get, it's I like, got it. I have it.
You got
I
all those
that.
Things. Dude, the irritable bowel is called Taco Bell, homie. You do not need to talk to your doctor.
Stop eating at Taco Bell.
You don't have that problem. So, I mean, Jonathan Haidt is a polarizing character anyway, but I think it's so unfair to blame social media. What really is happening is I have the ability to conversate with friends from all around the world, and we have such deeper connections. I've learned so much more about, you know, where people are. The connections, I mean, come on. Like, I met Leo IRL, like, over 15 years ago in Petaluma, and we still converse to this very day. You know, it was a Macworld somewhere at the Chieftain, knocking back drinks and, you know, talking about the internet one day, and then I came to Petaluma. And, like, none of that would exist without...
I wouldn't know you.
You know what I'm saying?
I wouldn't know
100%.
You.
100%.
You're right. Or
I'm sorry. These people need to... It's an excuse because no one wants to take responsibility for the fact that they are not doing what they should be doing in order to foster beautiful relationships.
Also, and this is maybe more serious, the author says the other problem is by finding this, you know, culprit, we're ignoring some genuine things we can do. For instance, there's only one school psychologist in the U.S. for every 1,119 students.
Thank you.
And there are lots of things we could do to improve mental health for young people. Banning social is not only going to do it.
The first place is diet. We won't even talk about that one.
Yeah.
One of the first places we could not cure, but alleviate some mental health issues is diet. We are pumping people with things that causes their emotions to go all over the planet. And we never talk about diet. We never talk about teachers. And nobody wants to pay the actual health care, which also might help. You know what I'm saying? Like during the performative years of your brain, a lot of kids are on low protein diets because they live in the food desert. But oh, we won't talk about that. Yep. We want to blame Instagram.
She concludes her Nature piece by saying, unfortunately, our time is being spent telling stories that are unsupported by research and that do little to support young people who need and deserve more. So, I agree. I think it's very easy to say it's a point. You made a good point. Jeff Jarvis has made this too. When people started reading books, there was a grave concern that we would, you know, lose our imaginative ability because our nose would be buried in books. And people were worried that people reading books and newspapers on trains would no longer socialize with one another and it would have a horrible effect on our society. There's always a culprit. There's always a moral panic. Maybe social is not the
and
big problem.
Everybody in computers starts using SSDs, then spinning hard drive makers will fail. And that's just horrible.
Yeah. What about that, Alan Malventano? Huh? Did you ever consider that? What?
If they got cheap enough, then yeah. Why wouldn't they?
Anyway, we'll see. I don't think TikTok is going to end up getting banned. We spent a long time talking about that a couple of weeks ago with Brianna Wu and Kathy Ellis fighting over that. Kathy saying it's a free speech issue. The government has no right to ban it. Brianna said, well, given my experience, and, you know, Alan, maybe you can back this up with intelligence agencies and politics and government. It is very clear that TikTok is actually a tool of the Chinese Communist Party and is problematic, to say the least, in its use and should be banned. I kind of agree with Kathy more than I agree with Brianna. Do you think, Alan, that the Chinese are using TikTok against us?
I wasn't doing that job when TikTok was around. However,
well, you have some expertise.
Yes, based on my own personal history, I would assume yes.
But how?
Probably.
How? I guess is
any
the
way that they want. Yeah. Is the problem.
But what could they do? What?
Just let's have access to all the databases, access to all the information.
Right.
Right. Access to influence the algorithms of which things are. Well, actually, hasn't that come out in some? There was somebody that looked into this and. Yeah,
they can influence Palestinian stuff. Yeah, whether it's
well, no, there was something about like if you could make the kids in other countries see less educational content bias than those in China, right? So anybody that's in China looking at TikTok, they should be warning all of the educational things.
Well, China doesn't even have TikTok.
TikTok is banned in China, ironically.
They have their own version. Yeah, that's completely different. Yeah. So,
right.
Yeah. There's. I mean, I think the fear is. I don't know if there's necessarily manipulation going on right now. There may be some, but I think the fear is that there could be a gradual turning up of the heat, the slow boiling effect, where they steer youth towards, counterculture ideas in the United States, for instance. And you could just do that very subtly, just start exposing people, because we know how impressionable youth are. We were all that age, you know. Everybody wants to rebel against the system, which is why you're seeing this supposed rise with communism and socialism amongst youth, because it's just that's the immediate rebelling you do against the system. It's like, well, I'll go to this other system, even though you don't know much about it necessarily. So they can manipulate it that way. I don't know if there's evidence for that. You know, I think they do run the risk if that starts happening. That, you know, then there's even more calls to sort of block the app or take action against them. You know, this is the whole idea of a free market, right? The idea is like eventually this stuff is scrutable and like you should be able to see what's happening with it. I think it's a dangerous idea just because if you do ban it, it's not like China's going to be like, all right, that's cool.
We give up.
Yeah. It's not like it's going to stop. So
they're
going
to be like, all right, well, we're just going to, you know, take similar actions.
They can still buy information from data brokers. In fact, just like our intelligence.
Somebody will come up with another app and just sell the info. So it's the same thing. And Daniel's right, because I remember, you know, as a punk rock kid of, say, circa 82, 83, we were all about anarchy. And then I joined the military and I was like, oh, yeah, anarchy is not a move. But at the time, you know, listening to Dead Kennedys and rocking my black clothes, you couldn't tell me anarchy wasn't the move, right? That's just because you're a kid and it seemed like fun and nobody could tell you what to do, you know?
I will say, in defense of anarchism, Spanish Civil War, if you go look at Catalonia, it was actually the CNT FAI. There's actually a pretty good anarcho-syndicalist movement that's still, and they're still around in Spain. They actually are still part of the union movement there. So technically it can work a little bit, but I get your point still, that is the immediate rejection of all authority. And that's what you do when you're young, which is kind of what's funny now. They're saying a lot of the youth are like becoming more puritanical for like sex and behavior and stuff as a rebelling against the adults who had a more open system. So I don't know if that's true, but.
Gen X, we ruined it for everybody because we was trying to. Never mind. This is a family.
Dvorak used to always quote Winston Churchill, who said, "If you are not a liberal at 25, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative at 35, you have no brain." I'm not sure. I think I still don't have a brain then.
The potential issue with the whole TikTok thing is, take the hypothetical. The U.S. government chose to start its own social platform.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to use that.
Right. You know, even if it looked completely unbiased.
To be honest, I'm much more afraid of my government than I am of China's government. I live in the U.S.
There you go.
Correct. However, you really wouldn't want other countries' governments having some influence on our people. Right. Yeah. Like that's potentially an issue, even if it was something as benign as like, this other government, they think that this issue is important to them. They're going to influence some results.
They're
by just
doing
a
that already on Twitter.
Yeah.
You're going to ban Twitter. Well, yeah. They're doing it already on Facebook. They're really doing it on Twitter. Are you going to ban Twitter? Oh, no, because it's an American company. It's OK.
And again, go to your local high school, look it up. Everybody do this. Ask them to have critical thinking classes in your high school. You know, talk about that. Like,
and then ask them if they sell red Solo cups for $5, because I hear there's a good party.
It's 25 now, but yeah. But yeah, we're missing the education side of it again. I think, you know, part of what happened to the U.S., and this is just me, I'm just guessing, I have no background, this is my anecdotal thoughts. We were top of the food chain for a while because we were very tight on like education. And then all of a sudden we got to the top of the food chain. We started trying to bully our way to stay at the top, and we ignored all the when Korea and Japan were like, we're going to give everybody internet. We're going to make it hella fast, and we're going to make school important. We're going to change school to 6 days a week because we're no longer an agricultural country. So we need the extra education. So no more Saturdays because, you know, your family runs a farm. We stopped that. They started going to school longer. We go to school 181 days a year. Japan, the kids are out of school 42 days a year. The rest of the time, they're in school, right? Like, we missed all of those opportunities. And to this day, if you say we're going to bring school and it will take out crime, it will make everybody smarter, but we're going to make school 6 days a week, people would have a cow. They would absolutely have a cow. No, because I'm going to spend quiet time with my kids. You know what parents do on Saturday? Tell their kids to go to the room and play video games while they get the time off because they're sick of work. Like,
Let me read Meredith Whitaker's response to the anti-TikTok movement. She's the president of Signal, the encrypted messaging system we were talking about. She says, I'm not a neutral observer. I take a position in the outcry camp. I see no evidence that this bill will offer a meaningful privacy protection from China, the United States, or anyone else, or liberate people from the mental buffeting of engagement-driven algorithms. What the bill would do is ensure that TikTok joins almost all the other widely used social media platforms on Earth under U.S. control. She's assuming the U.S. would buy it. Enriching U.S., not Chinese interests, and further entrenching U.S. social network dominance. U.S.-owned social media platforms include the top four most widely used services in the world, with TikTok lagging far behind YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and WhatsApp. By the way, of those four, three are owned by Meta. 19 of the 20 most widely used social media platforms in the world are based either in the United States or China, making all other countries consumers, not developers of these services. That's a good point, too. Anyway, I don't
think... The only issue is she doesn't have much of a solution, which she admits, you know, right. But it's like... Well, what do you do in this situation?
But banning TikTok is not one of the solutions, by the way.
Right, exactly.
Steve Mnuchin has jumped in, the former Secretary of the Treasury under the last administration, said, I'll buy TikTok, but Steve, you're not going to get the algorithm because the Chinese government won't let you have that. Oh, don't worry. We'll make our own. To widespread laughter. Like, oh, we could do that. That's easy. I don't. That's not a problem at all. Let's take a break. Got still more to talk about. What a great panel. I love having you guys on. It's old friend week. So nice to see Alan Malventano, former host of This Week in Computer Hardware. He's now in charge of SSD technologies at Phison. And whenever I have a question about SSDs, this is the guy I go to. He is the expert. So nice to have you here. Thank you, Alan. And I love your collection of G-Jaws and
junk.
Gimcracks. Yeah. Wow. Is that just for broadcast purposes or is that your actual?
No, that's just the office, the background of the office. Actually, this is a rare stuff back here. Optane wafers.
Optane. Whatever happened to Optane?
Well, Intel spent about $7 billion too much on it.
Sold it off, I believe. Yeah.
That was the...
It's not sold off. They just sunsetted it.
Memory that was... So fast, but it could be used as storage.
It's a buffer memory almost. It was like a pre-buffer for SSDs almost.
Yeah.
HP used it in their laptops.
Why did it? Why did it fail?
I never noticed it.
I worked on the SSD that you're talking about, actually.
Oh, did you?
Yes. And the biggest pain in the butt was if you were putting it in a laptop where the places where Optane was a lot faster than NAND, the unfortunate thing was that if you just looked at its raw speed, it looked amazing. But if you put it actually in a system and you tried to use it, well, the bottleneck would immediately shift to the CPU or other parts of the system. So you would get some performance gain, but it would almost immediately be kneecapped because now you have just, you know, firmly shifted that performance bottleneck elsewhere. Right. So
it explains why I literally never noticed a difference.
Right. And there were some things that you could have done on that HP laptop that you probably would have noticed, but again, it was not everything. It was a subset of types of things that you would do where, you know, you would see most of that benefit. But yeah, I mean, they made it in all sorts of forms, right? It was
Tri-X memory, that triple layer memory, that was the commercial name for it. It was Optane.
No, it was CrossPoint.
CrossPoint. That's what I. How did that work out?
See, here's the really crazy thing. Leo, back when you were doing screensavers.
Yeah.
I mean, the original screensavers, not the new screensavers. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there were several topics about the elusive phase change memory.
Oh, yeah.
It was like the flying car of memory, right? Like, and it was always over the horizon. Someone someday is going to crack it. Someone's going to do it. Well, guess what? That stuff actually is phase change memory. Oh. Intel just never wanted to admit it.
Oh, okay.
So it's like they did it. They actually did it. And then like, oh, but we don't want to call it that because of branding or whatever. I don't know, whatever the reason was. But one of the many reasons for its demise probably is they could have made much more, fanfare over it than they did. But yeah, and part of the problem is it came out kind of too early for its time. It came out, it's like this reverse Goldilocks thing, right? If it had come out 30 years ago, everything would have it. It would be everywhere.
Right.
Because operating systems would be booting directly from it. Like, architecturally, things would have evolved differently if that type of memory was available.
But we've gone too far down a different road, and so there was no...
We went too far down that road. And in the meantime, CPUs were just slow enough where if you put this really crazy fast storage in a system, then you'd get what Daniel ran into, which was bottleneck shift elsewhere. You couldn't really take full advantage of it. It was, you know... So, yeah, it was the inverted Goldilocks zone, if you will. It's really weird. And then it died, which is really a shame, right? Because it's not around.
And to be fair, I was going to say PCIe 5 and eventually 6, it's absurdly fast. Like, the amount of, like, they doubled the speeds between the generations. Like, it's getting kind of insane now. So they made a lot of progress there.
Yeah, and now working at Phison, I can say it's pretty dang tough to make an SSD that can saturate Gen 5 bandwidth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. That's especially in an M.2 form factor.
That's impressive.
We're doing it.
Yeah,
we have 14 gig per second M.2 SSDs. You better make sure there's at least a heat spreader on the thing because, you know, it's...
it gets a little warm, does it?
It does consume some power, yes. Yeah. But one of the things that we're actually proud of on that is that you only really need the factory heat spreader. You don't need like an active heat sink with a fan or heat pipes or any of the other craziness. Like, we managed to get it to go full speed, but not needing crazy cooling. Cause that's actually bad for an SSD. Like, if you run your NAND flash at room temperature and you like forced it to be room temperature with like a water block or something crazy like that, if you wanted to be a really crazy overclocker type person, you actually cut the endurance of the SSD in half.
No kidding. It wants to be warm.
Yeah. Really? When it's active, it wants to be warm because you're trying to force electrons to go on the other side of an insulative material. Hmm. So the cooler it is, the harder it is for that to happen.
Interesting.
Right? So when it's active, when you're actively reading, writing, doing all the things to it, you want it to be on the warmer side, and it's actually designed and rated to operate that way.
What's the optimal temperature?
Well, if you want the perfect optimal temperature, you'd look at the JEDEC spec. I think for client SSDs, I want to say it's like 40°C
active temperature. Wow, that's hot.
Yeah, that's the expectation is that it's going to be warmer, not room temperature when it's active. Now, when it's not active, you want it to be typically like room temperature.
Right.
Right. In fact, the endurance rating or the retention rating per JEDEC, which is, now that you've stored the data, how long is it able to hold it, guaranteed, or at least per the spec guaranteed. And for client SSDs, that's 52 weeks. But that temperature is not 40°C. It's the lower temperature. It's like 25 or 30°C. Right. So the expectation is if it's off, the computer's off, it should be able to hold it for a year. Right. But if you ran the system active and forced it to be cold, then you're just eating the NAND alive, right? You're just really beating it up in order to accomplish those rates.
So don't put your CPU cooler on your heat, on your RAM.
On your RAM.
On your SSD,
yeah.
Man, Alan, I just want to say real fast, inverted Goldilocks zone is the name of my Kansas cover band.
Oh, okay.
So this is all very interesting. So SSDs are not rated to store that memory more than a year.
That is the JEDEC rating, which is the spec that the manufacturers are supposed to test to, but that 1-year rating is at the end of life.
Okay.
So that is, it is the worst case. You have exhausted all of the rights. You have done the drive rights per day for the entire warranty period, and it's the very last day, and then you turn the system off. It should hold that data for a year and be able to read it.
You really don't want to take that SSD and put it in the closet wrapped in bubble wrap, expecting to see it again in 5 years, because there's not going to be anything there.
See, here's the other thing. I have SSDs on the shelf behind me. I even have like an X25M.
Wow.
That I put data on back.
Old Intel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The old Intel drive, the first like client
that
SSD that Intel made, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was many years ago. That thing still reads its data just fine.
Oh, okay.
There's a few reasons for that.
It's
number
not
one,
good archival storage, though, right? I mean, it's not preferred.
It's not intended to be archival storage,
right?
But it is possible to use an SSD for an archive type of thing. Like, you don't have to assume that it would only hold it a year and that's it. It's just gone after that, especially if you've not exhausted all of its cycles, right? So if it's a brand new SSD and you used it as a backup drive, for example, and you only wrote once or twice to it, well, that SSD is going to hold it for much longer than a year. There's not necessarily any guaranteed specification around that, but since you haven't really worn it all out, chances are you can come back in 5 years. It's probably still there and still readable just fine.
Is this is this a landmark in computing where the I/O is actually now as fast as storage, or has it always been a seesaw battle back?
You gotta be careful. There's bandwidth and there's latency. The latency, you know, we keep increasing the bandwidth. We keep increasing PCIe, you know, Gen 5, Gen 6. So, yeah, you can move more bits in a straight line. But the thing that is the real limiting factor on SSDs that you run into in your regular computing experience is the latency. I've asked for one piece of information. How long did it take to look that up and give it to me? Regardless of how fast it actually transferred across
the box. I thought there was no latency in SSD. It's random access, right? I mean, we'd have to wait for the drive to come around again.
Correct. Yes. Hard drives are in milliseconds, right? SSDs are in microseconds.
But there's still some latency.
They still add up.
Yeah, yeah.
There's still some, and it still does add up. You know, if you do a bunch of them in a row, right? Many things that you do on your computer is read the little piece of information, and then that information told me what to do with where to look for the next piece of information, right? So that results in a chain of events that will, all those individual latencies will stack up on each other. And that's what turns into the responsiveness of your system, like how snappy your system feels, is that latency. And right now, NAND latencies are on the order of 40 to 50 microseconds.
That's pretty good.
The Optane stuff we were just talking about, well, Optane was like 7 to 10.
Wow.
But it was 7 to 10 in a point in time where most of the NAND was running at 80 to 100.
Uh-huh.
So it was like 10 times faster. That was the number you kept saying Intel say. And they weren't lying when they said that either. It's just that if you went much faster than 50, you were bottlenecking everywhere else in the system anyway. Because the kernel didn't know what to do with, you know, in many cases, the data was ready before the interrupt, like in a shorter time than the interrupt could even fire within the CPU.
What's going on? What?
See, and this is eventually architectures are going to need to change at a fundamental level, even within Windows, because eventually the NAND SSDs are going to become fast enough over, you know, give it enough, a couple more years, right? NAND latencies are going to be so low that they will be on par with how long it takes Windows to service the interrupt. And the whole interrupt thing was from hard drives.
Right.
That's why it existed, right? You asked a hard drive for a piece of information. It's literally an eternity as far as the CPU goes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So of course, the CPU is going to go off, do some other stuff, and wait for an interrupt to occur, which literally interrupts the CPU and is like, okay, my data is ready, right? But if the interrupt takes like 10 microseconds to handle, and the SSD is ready, is it like complete within 10 microseconds, why are you going to divert your attention to something else only to have to immediately turn back around and, you know, figure out what to do with the data, right? You might as well just wait because it's going to be ready, you know, more quickly than it would take to interrupt yourself later.
How much of this gets changed by what Apple's doing with unified memory?
For storage?
Not much. We're still waiting for the storage.
Probably not much. Well, see, they're so integrated, they know exactly how long the memory will take.
Right.
Because they are effectively a closed vertical, vertically integrated ecosystem, right? So they're able to tune specifically for that. You can't do the same thing on a Windows system, right? Because the SSD, the storage could be any speed.
Yeah.
Right. Even if it was, even if you limited it to SSDs, the SSD latency could be within a certain range that you couldn't make an assumption about. Even for Linux, there are tunable parameters where you can go in and say, I wish you to do what's called hybrid polling, which is where instead of waiting on an interrupt, it will say, well, I know this SSD takes about this long, so I'm going to go off and do something else. But then after a few microseconds before I expect to be ready, I will come back and start asking it if it's there yet. Almost like a kid in the back of a car on a road trip.
We're there,
right?
We have reached an amazing point in this technology. It's just mind-boggling what's going on. Are there new architectures out there for this?
CXL.
CXL. Okay.
Yep, CXL is a different unified or a different memory architecture. It's taking quite a long time to catch on.
Do you think people will build CXL hardware?
Well, I mean,
is the demand of AI driving any of this? I mean,
oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well,
you look at what NVIDIA announced, right? With the new processor. Yeah.
I work at a storage company. I was on the floor at GTC with a product to show.
Oh, really? At the NVIDIA conference. Nice.
At the NVIDIA conference. Right. At the NVIDIA AI-focused conference. Not GDC, which is more the gaming one, but
conference.
GTC.
GTC, yeah.
Yeah, which is more the technology one, right? We have a thing we kind of soft-launched it at CES, but didn't officially say anything about it. And then we did the legitimate launch, even showed a system running the thing real time at GTC.
So I always assumed that building these models was CPU or NPU bound, not storage bound. But I guess you have these large data sets, it's going to end up being RAM or storage bound at some point.
Yes. Go ahead, Daniel.
I was going to say, Micron is like really big in this area. This is where they make all the server side memory stacks that are needed for AI, and it's really driving the competition. They're kind of ahead of Samsung, I believe, right now too for this stuff. So,
is it DDR5 or is it
DDR? I think that's a part of it. HBM3X is the the new one.
High bandwidth memory.
Yeah,
and there are ways to do it on a smaller scale without needing high bandwidth memory, which is actually the product we launched. Since we happen to make a bunch of M.2 SSDs, we figured, well, why the heck wouldn't we figure out some way to apply this to AI? In this case, it's fine tuning. So, yes, Leo, what you said earlier was correct. Usually you want training and in the case of our example, fine tuning, which is where you take the existing model that was trained with an enormous amount of GPUs somewhere in a Meta data center or elsewhere, right? You could take that and then apply your own specific data set and sort of, I don't want to call it retrain, but the technical term is called fine tuning,
right?
Which is where you take your data and you sort of intermingle it with the existing trained model, right? And the idea is that you want to be able to ask the AI about things, you know, you want it to have context of your own stuff. And so in order to do that, you have to do this fine tuning pass. Well, usually you would need to have enough GPU memory to hold the whole thing, or at least in order to do this fine tuning efficiently, you would need to be able to do that. So our product takes some SSDs that we make. We run them in pure SLC mode. Usually a client M.2 SSD does like a half to one drive write per day rating as far as how much you can write to it within its lifetime. These SSDs are 100 drive writes per day. So you can beat the crap out of these SSDs with writes, and they are very good for caching. But what we'll do is we'll take the model, we'll sort of break it up into smaller chunks for the GPUs to nibble on, if you will, and we use the SSD as a background cache for all of that larger set of data that needs to pass through all the GPUs during the fine tuning, and then it effectively keeps, because of the speed of our SSDs, it effectively keeps a fewer number of GPUs busy 100% of the time.
Oh, interesting.
So,
wow.
So you can do this fine tuning and not need to rent space on Amazon, or in some cases, people like in the education sector or even HIPAA for medical, people that are not allowed to take their data set and send it out of their building, right? They want to be able to do it locally. They also don't want to spend a $1.5 million on a rack full of very expensive GPUs.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Right. So as long as you're willing to wait longer, you can do this same operation on a workstation size system with our solution.
It sounds like, which is to me, this is one of the benchmarks of whether a technology is real and has legs. It sounds like, just as gaming for a long time drove the GPU and CPU market and Windows market, that AI is starting to drive a hardware market, and that tells me something.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to see the system, the article I dropped in the end of the show notes there, that's a Tom's Hardware article covering our system. We partner with Main Gear. They built an incredible looking, really nice workstation.
Yeah, Main Gear's been making a lot of attention. We got a lot of press releases from them. They're doing a lot of cool stuff with AI and making it accessible to people at home.
They built us a workstation. I think it's the second picture in the article, Leo. It's a quad 6000 ADA workstation.
Jeez.
Yeah.
70 billion parameters. Holy cow. How much, just out of curiosity, would such a device cost?
I think that particular build is somewhere upwards of 50 to 60K.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
But you have to realize the GPUs, I think, are more than half of the cost of
that
system.
That's right. That's right.
It's four of NVIDIA's top GPUs.
Yeah, it's four RTS 6000s.
Cut any corners and get the Amazon Basics adapter to connect it to the HDMI, though.
Yeah, that's the problem.
As long as Apple's not selling it.
This
stuff is going to be super important, because what's going to really happen now is, you know, everybody talked about LLMs. A lot of them are hosted, of course, on the cloud, and, you know, we have things like what Microsoft is using. But what's going to be the important thing is local LLMs that companies will use, whether it's a law firm, it's technical industries.
Just companies. Us, in the long run, us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Because you can feed your own internal info.
On device, I don't want to give my precious knowledge that I've collected over 67 years of life to, you know, OpenAI on their server. I want to do it on device. And I think that's very exciting. Plus, I think, honestly, that I don't want Google or Microsoft or anybody to own this. I think open source is very important. So I think the idea of running this stuff locally, being able to run it locally, is extremely important.
And I want Gen AI to rebuild the parts that I used up with those Red Cup parties in the 80s.
You're going to have to put your brain in the machine. Can you do that? Are you willing to do that?
I'm down.
Yeah. So in our case, you have different size models that are available. And so just to give the very simplified version of this, why the size of an AI model matters, is it's almost as if you had this lossy compression algorithm that you could apply to a whole set of data.
Right.
So when you train an AI model, the number of parameters in the model is effectively like how big its brain is.
Yeah. Right? Like 7 billion is like the standard, right?
Yeah.
Well, 70 billion, it's pretty large. It's something that you can't actually fine tune on those four GPUs without our solution, right? Like you need our solution and have fast SSDs and everything to be able to do that. For just with that GPU memory, if you wanted to fine tune a model, usually you'd be limited to 7 billion. So we can 10x.
Yeah, that's what I, when I do this at home with Llama or Mistral, these are 7 billion token sets.
Right.
And otherwise you need a terabyte of RAM or more.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, now granted, that workstation does have half a terabyte of RAM in it.
Wow.
And it does need to use a decent chunk of it when it's doing the fine tuning of a 70 billion model.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Fascinating. But the key is that it needs a lot more than a half a terabyte of total cached data in order to be able to pass all of it through the GPUs to do the fine tuning, right? It's more like a terabyte and a half.
Yeah, which is 1.4.
VRAM spread across 24 AI GPUs, spread across 6 servers in a server rack.
Right.
Or
exactly.
And get yourself one of these Fizon devices, this Main Gear Pro AI device. You could do it at home.
That's the idea.
And by the way, there's another economic reason why this might be pushed down locally, is it's very expensive for companies like Microsoft and Google to run these on the server.
That's why you're seeing, Microsoft is pushing hybrid AI models for this reason, because it's going to slow innovation if it's all cloud-based, right? And now that's why you're seeing, NPUs are such a big deal in PCs, because the NPU is what's going to allow this localized processing. Intel just this week in Taipei was announcing its next step in its developer tools. They came out with a mini PC, basically with an NPU built into it for developers so that they can build these apps that will leverage the NPU. But like, that's where it's going to be, because you will see way more innovation on that end with software developers making AI actually accessible through their apps directly. That'll cut down on latency, cuts down on privacy, cuts down on costs. You know, all that comes, you know, with having a localized AI model. So.
Let's take a little break, because I do want to talk a little bit. Microsoft this week talked a lot about the so-called AI PC. They announced the new Surface 10 and so forth. I'd love to get your take on that, Daniel, in just a bit. Daniel Rubino is here from Windows Central. He's editor-in-chief. Doc Rock in the purpleness of his grotto. He's our Easter bunny for this week. Great to have you, youtube.com/DocRock. And Alan Malventano, who might be in a submarine right now. I don't know.
There's a picture over there.
Do they have screen doors in submarines?
No.
No. Okay. Just checking. Our show today brought to you by NetSuite. The less your business spends on operations, multiple systems, and delivering your product or service, well, you know what that means. More margin for you. More money you keep. In order to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR all into one platform, which means a single source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud. No hardware required and can be accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. One's kind of the operative word here. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And, of course, one source of truth, one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. Do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Even more reason to check it out at NetSuite.com/twit. NetSuite.com/twit. Now through April 15th. That means you only have a couple of weeks, if you're listening live, maybe less if you've downloaded the show, to check out this one-of-a-kind flexible financing program at NetSuite.com/twit. We thank him so much for supporting the show. So is that just a marketing term, AI PCs, or really is there something there? Microsoft really.
Oh, there's something to it.
There's a Copilot key on the damn thing.
So I think, you know, for instance, we just got word of Acer has a new laptop coming out with an older AMD processor, and it has the Copilot key. It's a $350 laptop, which is great. Is that an AI PC? No, it's a PC with AI. So that's the distinction there.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Should I buy PC? A Surface 10? If I want to play with AI, is that what I need?
Yeah. So an AI PC, by definition, will be something that has a modern chipset that has an NPU on it. The NPU is really the key part.
Oh, that's
here.
Okay. So, I have a Macintosh that has an NPU on it.
Technically true.
My iPhone has an NPU on it. This is actually kind of catch up for Microsoft, really.
Yeah. And so, you know, Intel has theirs on the Core Ultra chip. AMD has theirs now on the Ryzen 7 and 8 series, I believe. And of course, Qualcomm is about to announce its, Snapdragon X Elite platform. Well, they already announced it, but it's going to be coming out real soon. And what you're going to see now is this sort of race, just like with GPUs, between like NVIDIA and AMD.
Oh, interesting.
In terms of performance. So I expect Qualcomm to have the fastest performing NPU, followed by AMD, and then Intel. Even though Intel is making the most noise here and has the most reach in the PC, theirs will probably be the slowest. But you're going to see these shift up to different sizes over the coming years and capabilities. But that's going to be sort of the new battleground. And as far as when customers will and consumers will see a difference in, you know, in use of this technology, that's where like Intel just announced with its developer tools, OpenVINO and everything, and this hardware, you know, I would say in 6 months, you're already starting to see it with enterprise. Intel announced back at World Congress. Their companies, like one company is, I forgot the name of them now, but they're using anti-phishing software via the NPU and AI. Oh. So instead of it going to the cloud, like an antivirus system would It's using its own heuristics locally using the NPU, and then it can use that data to update other data files in the cloud for other systems. So you're going to see like a lot of that kind of technology come out. And I think that's super critical. Phishing is such one of the biggest security risks right now for enterprise and business. You also just see it integrate into just a bunch of apps, whether it's photo editing, video editing, all this kind of stuff. You're already seeing it. Of course, Microsoft's putting in all their services. The big thing you'll see this fall is with Windows 11. Microsoft is putting AI throughout the operating system to enhance its search abilities. Like finally, search will be good on Windows. It'll be contextual based instead of using keywords. And it'll be able to search across your devices and different systems. So you're going to start to see this AI kind of just weave throughout the system. And instead of being like a centralized, assistant, it's going to be just all these little parts. That said, something like Copilot itself is a front end. I know a lot of people associate Copilot, Microsoft, with OpenAI, which is true, but the actual back end of Copilot can be configured with basically any kind of AI system they want to put in place there, including those provided by PC and laptop makers who can put their own in there, as well as other companies who can then integrate into Copilot itself. So you just have like one centralized AI system in the PC. It's going to be a really interesting thing for the next year, I think, to see where all this goes.
Are you a believer? I mean, I was a little skeptical for some time. It really felt like we were kind of on the hype cycle with this, and maybe it was overhyped. We've certainly had AI winters before, but I'm starting to see so much interesting stuff happening with AI. I'm starting to think maybe this thing has some legs. What's your point of view?
I think this is, if this is a bubble or just a fad, I've never seen the PC industry pivot so fast and hard towards a new technology.
Well, but they needed something to drive sales, right? There's been no reason to buy a new PC, and it's killed the market effectively.
Yeah, although that cycle is going to take place in 2025 anyway, just because that's the usual upgrade cycle for enterprise due to the big, burst in 2020.
Everybody bought a bunch in COVID, and now we're going to wait five years until we get the new ones. Yeah.
But that said, enterprise and business, like, there is so much interest and possibility with AI. A lot of it, too, still needs to be defined. I wouldn't look at this as the early days of the internet, where, sure, we would get onto the web. The web was new back before there was FTP and there was Gopher and all these, and then there was like email, and then the web came out, but no one was anticipating like Google Maps and Tinder and like all these other services that have come out since. So that's kind of where we are right now, where there are definitely some dedicated use cases that are going to be, you'll see a lot in enterprise and business, and then some in consumer, but a lot of it will still be defined by developers over the next coming years as they get their hands on this hardware, developer tools, and kind of where the industry goes. But yeah, I see this as, you can even start to question the UI and UX of computers in general about how we're going to be using these things, right? Wow. Because there could be so many changes in how smart these systems get. And they've really advanced, I think, faster than most people anticipated in the last 2 years. So I think it's really cool.
The analogy of the internet's interesting because I think this is the case probably with most new technologies, but certainly with the internet. When we first encountered it, we saw it through the lens of our own expertise. So, people worked in radio thought, oh, it's a new way to do radio. People worked in publications said, oh, it's a new way to print our magazine or our newspaper. We very much just used it to do what we'd already been doing. The same thing happened, by the way, Jeff Jarvis tells me, when Gutenberg invented the printing press, they just took the scribes out of the scriptorium, the monks writing the Bibles, and printed them. They printed Bibles. That's all they did.
Yep.
But it takes a little while, and then new uses for technology emerge. It feels to me like that's happening faster with AI than it took 100 years for the printing press to be used for something besides Bibles. And that's, by the way, when novels were invented, when plays were invented. It was a real transformation. The internet, it took maybe a decade. Google Gmail is 20 years old. The internet itself is almost exactly 30 years old. So it took about a decade. Yeah. AI ain't going to take a decade, it feels like.
Because it's the first one that can improve itself.
Yeah.
Like none of the other technologies. Well, I mean, serious.
AI has no preconceived notions about what it could be doing.
Right. None of the other technologies could self-improve. Yeah, and this one can to a certain extent. I mean, there's still a lot of human input and a lot of retraining. But, I mean, it can train itself at night. You know, as we're submitting our errors and our feedback and doing all this other stuff, it's just progressively getting better.
Once we get to the singularity, it's going to be bye-bye. I hope, have fun. I'll see you later.
I think the biggest challenge is honestly getting over the FUD, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Yeah,
and I think the medical stuff, you know, is really being helpful and helping, you know, crunch numbers really, really quickly. I think in some of those situations where people can see pure positive outcomes, not, you know, a writer strike or just some of the dumb images that people create with AI. I just saw one the other day, which was super stupid. And they're like, oh, this tank in this country is bringing all of these soldiers in and they're going to do something. I was like, bro, the helmet is completely wrong. The thing that's sitting on top is wrong. The way the military helmet was cut was wrong. Like, it's so easy to tell that was a fake image, but, you know, everybody was sharing it. And all you have to do is look at the text on the bottom of the trailer, because none of the text was actual words.
Well, you always know when it's AI these days, because we're very well tuned to notice the uncanny valley.
Some are.
But I think some of that is a misuse of AI. It's saying, oh, we'll just use AI to take over from artists or writers. Maybe that's not what AI is going to end up being great at. Dan?
No.
There'll be some of that. I think there is, you know, like I was just talking about, that there's a lot of fear right now. I think the big thing is consumer education. People just associate AI right now with chatbots and generating images, right? But that's
trivial.
That's literally the tip. Like, that's not where this stuff is going to go. Once it's starting to be integrated in all sorts of systems, and this is where Microsoft is getting a lot of credit, especially from, you know, investors, because they've so quickly integrated AI into all their products. It's been kind of absurd.
It's brilliant. They're now a $3 trillion company all of a sudden, right?
Yeah. The one that I want to see happen more than other, purely selfishly, is the real-time human translation. All right. As a minor omniglot.
That's almost, that's practically there. When we were in Mexico,
it is
there was a Japanese gentleman who didn't speak any Spanish. The hotel staff didn't speak any Japanese. They were talking through the phone. Back and forth.
I told them to call me. I can do both.
I know you can. They needed a doc, but they have the doc program, you see.
And so that's what I mean, Leo. There was a lady, she was from Latvia, and she had this little device, which is kind of common in Asia. The name begins with a P, but it was really small. And it wasn't the jinky fake ones. This was a new thing. Kind of cool. And she was trying to explain to the guy, and the words were right, but the problem in this particular case was a technology gap.
It's not idiomatic.
It wasn't a language gap. It was a technology gap, right? Yeah. And because me having been an ex-genius and understanding the technology, I was like, I speak Japanese and your English is good enough. What are you trying to say? And I was like, oh, the reason why your thing can't do that is you're asking for the wrong thing. And so I just translated to the guy. She was basically trying to find the right lens to get that good background compression when you do photos. But all of background compression has a lot of different meaning and a lot of different contexts. And the translator thing couldn't pick up. She was speaking in the photography context.
So is this it? The Pocket
LLM
Talk
could do that.
This is $300.
Yes, Pocket Talk.
Pocket Talk.
That's exactly it. Exactly.
Very interesting.
That thing is good. That thing is really good.
Not good enough for technical conversation.
Because the context switching is the one thing that fails all translation programs.
Right.
Especially when you deal with a place like Japan, which is a high context society versus a low cut. Never mind. That's a complicated conversation. But it didn't understand that gap, but it's getting there.
We're making leapfrog progress in that, though.
Right.
Right.
I think it's just
training issue.
It's the language I want. I want that when I say something to Karen, if she says something to me, we know what we're talking about, it will cause less problems.
Oh, you want a male to female translator? That's going to cost a lot.
I wasn't going to say it that much, Leo, because that's how you get in trouble. I just meant like any domestic partner situation. If you get unscrewed domestic partner situations, then
what she's trying to tell you is you're a doofus.
Yes, exactly.
We need AI as the middle person to balance arguments, you know, and weigh in on the matter.
I honestly have gone from being an AI skeptic, thinking it was really just a parlor trick, to as I deepened my use of it and understanding of it, and actually used it more, realizing that this is a breakthrough, I think, and it's going to be pretty amazing and maybe a little bit weird in the next 5 to 10 years.
Again, and I think the internet makes a great comparison to that, because I was on the web in 1994, you know, but like I was in high school and no one else was, right? Like it was weird to talk about like all the things you can do, but I was like, do you know how much like potential this has for knowledge?
And people said,
And it's like, I know I'm biased because of like Microsoft and Copilot, but like I pay for their premium version because I use it all the time. But because I'm an inquisitive person, I'm always researching, asking questions, and the ability for it to summarize, go out there, get the data, summarize it for me, give me the main talking points without me looking at 20 tabs of data and going through, like, it just saves so much more time. And it's just, there's the accuracy kind of issue, but I honestly haven't run into much of that. And plus that's just going to get better over time. So, but the rate at which this is improving, I think, is just going to be interesting. Like I said, this next year is going to be a critical year, and it's going to be a critical year, I think, for PC, just because ARM, you know, Qualcomm's new chip now is going to be something actually competitive against Apple. You have the AI stuff. You have the refresh cycle. It's a perfect storm of all this new technology that's coming around that's going to really sort of, I think, change the way we work, the way we behave.
How important is Windows on ARM for all this?
So, I mean, I think it's pretty crucial, right? Because the whole battery life and performance metric is so key now.
And although they have an NPU, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. They're a very powerful NPU. Actually, like, I think it's the most powerful. It's a double-edged sword, though, right? I think Apple's facing this situation. I've never seen so many MacBooks on sale. It has to do with the previous generations, the M2s and the M1s, which are still around.
Right.
The fact is if you have an M1 and you're a pretty normal average user, like 80% of their users,
you're fine.
There's no need to upgrade to an M3. It's almost too good of a device now. So, like, you're seeing a lot of these M1s and M2s now discounted. But a lot of people aren't going for the M3s either. So it's like, that's why Apple's in a, I almost feel bad for Apple. They're in a really weird pinch where MacBook sales are lagging. They're getting hammered by the EU. Now the Department of Justice, the iPhone has issues in China. Like they're kind of getting hammered. they had to cancel their car.
Yeah.
And what did they and what did they do with all that staff? Put them on AI because they're behind on that too.
Right.
You know, so it's like, they're really sort of in a weird kind of position right now where they're just kind of getting hammered from all sides. And then you have, of course, Vision Pro, which, by the way, did you ever buy one?
You got one, Doc?
I love mine. I don't know where.
When's the last time you wore it?
Right before I left to go on a plane, and I seriously thought about taking it. The one thing that I didn't take it for is I knew there was such a short flight, and I was just packing light to move. But my next flight, which is in like 2 weeks, I'm actually going to bring it. And I just got introduced to a smaller bag inside of the Belkin one, so that
I think, honestly, looking at how, and I'm a real Vision Pro skeptic, so consider the source. But looking at how people are using it, it's really mostly for watching movies. That's pretty much it. Everything else is kind of gimmicky. It's just mostly for watching 100%. Movies.
100%. Yeah. But I tell you what, here, this is a funny situation because I was during that transition when I first went to, Leo and I, we both grew up in the Chuck Taylor era, right? Basically sneakers for school, for gym were Chuck Taylor's, $10, hard as a rock, completely bad for your ankles.
I wore no kids. I'm sorry. I don't
same
know.
Thing.
I had kids.
Same thing. Same shape though. Same shape, right? Even the Maypops, they were flat. There's no EVA. It was real vulcanized Goodyear rubber.
Yeah, right.
But being a kid that graduated in 84, when the waffle sole came out and the arch support and all that stuff came out, I literally remember my speed increasing in track. I held a couple state records in track.
No kidding.
So the technology at the time, it was just fashion. But then, you know, people that bought into it, our school got into BR, and, you know, guys started wearing tights and track in order to, you know, slimline the legs and keep them warm before you run. And the speeds immediately increased. Sure. I think that it's just at that early part, it's just that difference between going from Chuck Taylors to like Nike and what was it called? Reebok and one other. Wasn't Adidas yet. It was Nike, Reebok.
I see kids
and Asics
wearing shoes today. They look like they got marshmallows on their feet.
Those are dumb. Those are so dumb. But like reality though, athletics changed in about 84 when shoe technology actually started making people actually better at sports and better supporting various sports. Like we were, I remember my first coach said, never run or play basketball in these running shoes. And I was like, why? These shoes are designed to go forward. They have no ability to go sideways. If you play in these, you're going to bust an ankle. And we were poor. We didn't think no better of it. And so many people would roll their ankles trying to play basketball in Nike Cortez. And then it all started to make sense. And they started building purpose-driven shoes. And everybody got better at the game. So I think that is in that weird inflection point right now where it's so brand new that nobody knows what to do with it, really. But it will catch on. And I think the other thing is you cannot help because of its shape, but to compare it to other headsets, it's not even in the same ballpark.
This is kids like today in high school wearing moon boots.
Those things are so dumb.
See, that's how I view Vision Pro. Those are the Vision Pro with the moon boots.
Those things are so dumb.
All right. I want to say, go ahead, Alan. Was that you?
No, I got nothing. I just keep picturing Doc on the airplane on his next flight, just doing this in the.
There is an airline that will not let you wear the. I think it was Air France won't let you wear a Vision Pro because they say you're not paying attention to safety regulations. I just saw an article.
You can see through it.
Yeah, I know.
Oh God! See, this is how when governments try to do stuff that don't make no difference.
I think it was the pilot.
It was France.
Yeah, it was Air France. I think it was a pilot that said no. We don't. But the pilot gets to do what they want. Let me see. Here's Air France's. It doesn't have a specific Vision Pro prohibition, but here is the Vision Pro not allowed on a flight in Air France.
I tell you the two things I do with it the most that would probably crack you up. I use it a lot for editing just because of making the gigantic screen. So I have Final Cut open. I got the gigantic screen right there. My MacBook's in front. And it's just really incredible to edit on 100-something-inch virtual screen. The second thing I do with it, I would say, is mental health related. I got the DJ app open. I retired from DJing like maybe 5 years ago. But I would sit there and just rock out for like an hour and a half.
So you're happy with your $3,500?
It was
worth it.
Absolutely. Because nice. I tell you what, I would have spent it on Japanese whiskey anyway.
best kind of whiskey.
I don't know. I would maybe want. Well, it's, can you do both is the question, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Because now guys, we just figure out how to do something else with it.
Has anyone tried the X-Reel Airs?
No,
those are like they're the $300 to $600 glasses. They have the pros, which are just coming out now that actually do have AR capabilities. But these are like if you just want to watch a movie or do computational work.
Ooh, look!
These are like for $350. You put them on.
Yeah.
Type C plugs into an iPhone, Android, PC, Xbox, whatever you want, and the quality of them are good. Now it's not, of course, Vision Pro good, right? Those are 4K. These aren't, but they are micro OLED, and they're actually way better than I would think.
Are they AR or are they VR? Can you see through them?
So you can see. So it goes to different stages. The Airs you can just see through, and then they have a clip-on thing that goes on to black them out. Then they have the next step up, which has photochromatic. So you touch a button, and they'll dim them and dim again until it's blacked out. And then they have the pros, which actually have AR. They actually have cameras on them, or RGB type sensors, I believe, that can actually detect your hands and do actual AR. So those are just coming out now for developers.
These look like regular spectacles. This is what I want.
Yeah.
This is so much better than I don't know how the quality is, but the idea.
It's actually, the quality is pretty darn good. I'm telling you. Oh yeah, I got a pair. We all do it, Windows Central, because they're good for plugging into like your an ROG Ally or Steam Deck, because you throw them on and now you have like the equivalent 100-foot display.
Yeah, see, that's the negative as far as I'm concerned about the Steam Deck is it's too small a screen for the PC gaming I want to do.
What's so funny about this is Sony made this years ago. I remember in our store back in like 2002. We used to sell a Sony, like you put it like Jordy LaForge, and it was basically a Vega for your face. And honestly, I think that's why I like the Apple Vision Pro so much, is because I had that Sony one, because it was part of our, you know, part of our kit for the store.
I
think the Vision Pro's tech is amazing. I just think
I should buy
a lot of it.
Yeah,
you should. You should really try them, Lee. I'm curious about your opinion on them, because whether you're on a flight, you just want to watch movies, like I said, they're not nowhere as good as Vision Pro because those are 4K, but being micro OLED, the field of view of these, the quality, the brightness, they're 500 nits. It's way better than I thought it would be. It's really impressive. And they're kind of a really cool company. The founder and CEO actually came out of Magic Leap from that company.
Oh, and interesting. But it's not the same technology.
No, but it's their technology. They actually design them and manufacture them. So they're not even like outsourcing this, although I imagine some of the OLED lenses are going to be a little bit outsourced. I believe Samsung might make them. But the audio is good on them, and it's just, they're just cool. I don't know. They're very practical, I would say.
See, I could be really hip. Instead of having a Vision Pro, I could have a $700 X-Real AR2 Ultra. I did buy some smart glasses, which are supposed to come in a couple of weeks, but I forgot what the company was.
I bought the Ray-Ban ones because of FSA, and then they sold out, and they're not coming back. So I think FSA changed their mind on everybody getting Ray-Bans.
Oh. They got way popular.
They did.
Surprisingly.
They did. Mike Elgin was trying to get me to buy those. All right, I want to take a little break. We have a fabulous little movie we made of all the fun things that happened this week on Twitter. And then we're going to wrap it up. Watch.
Cyber News headline was, M-Series Max can leak secrets due to inherent vulnerability. The only thing that's inherently vulnerable here is the credibility of the tech press's coverage of this.
Holy cow.
It really has been quite over the top.
Previously on Twitter. Security Now.
It's not a vulnerability in Apple Silicon. By the time we're done, everyone is going to understand exactly what happened, why it happened, how it happened, and you could go to a cocktail party and really put your friends to sleep.
This is the Untitled Linux Show. This week we're talking about AMD's FSR going open source, Redis tightening the noose, Linux has arrived with malware, and more. You don't want to miss it.
Windows Weekly.
We are eagerly awaiting the first Qualcomm X Elite-based PCs. The headline that games will run fine on ARM seems not to make sense. It doesn't seem believable. But what they're saying, Qualcomm, is that the performance of the GPU is not an issue.
MacBreak Weekly.
The Department of Justice, they're going after Apple.
I would argue that Apple built Apple Pay the way it did because it wanted complete control so it could launch that product in a market that had resisted contactless payment for ages. The problem is that they never, ever, ever, ever opened it up to third parties to compete with Apple in other ways. And like, if you're at the DOJ, you might argue it's an original sin.
Twit for justice.
Oh, hi. It was a great week on Twit. And next week is going to be really interesting. On the next week's show, we're going to have a live studio audience. I'm very excited about this. Yeah, we haven't done that since the COVID days. Remember that? The pandemic? We had to wear masks.
It's like 5 years ago.
It feels like, I know.
What the hell?
It feels, it is.
Isn't
it was
crazy
4 years
how
ago.
Fast that was?
Yeah.
4 years ago, yeah.
So if you are in the club, I think we're sold out, but you could find out more April 8th and April 21st. Live studio audience. It'll be so fun. I think we're going to have mostly a live panel. I know Micah Sargent will be joining us. Amanda Silberling will join us next week. Abrar-Al-Hiti in 3 weeks. So we're going to have some other people in studio. Be a lot of fun. We're going to break out the fezzes. And
just a correction. It's Lisa Schmeiser tomorrow.
Oh, it's Schmeiser tomorrow. Yeah, next week. Sorry about
that. That's what set me up. Benito set me up and told me I had to be in the live audience.
You can fly in from Hawaii.
I just flew home yesterday. Oh, I wouldn't extend my trip.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm bummed. Yeah, you were at the podcast movement. Was that good? Is there hope amazing. At all for podcasting?
Oh, man, the industry is booming right now. Yeah. It's actually pretty good. I think the thing that scares everybody is the big dudes came in and the big dudes kind of like overplayed their hand a little bit. Now they're trying to figure it out. But there's some really good stuff out right now.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, Amy Sedaris is the bomb.
I love her.
Oh, my God.
She
was so good. You have to listen to Dr. Sheila. It is hilarious. And she is very good.
So maybe really the problem is not so much that advertising is gone. It's just that people don't want to hear us anymore. They've got better choices. And we're just going to have to fold up our tent. But maybe not.
I would not say better choices, but definitely more choices.
More entertaining.
Well, in a way, too. A lot of the conversation is around what you're doing. So you're doing the right thing. And this is what
the club,
I tell my YouTube creator. Yes, yeah. Membership is better because I know exactly what I'm getting. And, you know, I'm paying for it. I don't have to worry about somebody else paying for it and then changing their mind. And then all of a sudden my coverage is gone. Right. Yeah. You know how many remember Chuck? I thought Chuck was a great show. I actually loved that show. And they couldn't get renewed for a season. And then we all had a cow. And we were like, Subway, you were the main sponsor for that show. And because of you, NBC is not going to renew Chuck. So you know what? We're not going to eat a $5 footlong, you jerks. 2 weeks later, NBC was like, hey, Levi, yeah, come on through. We need you to record another season.
That saved 100%. Chuck? 100%. Your unwillingness to eat a $5 footlong? That was
the
it.
The nerds saved Chuck. Now, had Chuck been a show that was a membership-based thing, it'd probably still be running because it was pretty good. And all the nerds loved it because anybody who ever worked in computer retail, you knew exactly what he was going through, minus the superhero stuff, because it was very real. So I know that at the time I was at CompUSA, we all like loved that show because it was really
I ever even heard of it.
Oh, it was great. It was on NBC and the nerds basically saved that show. So I think membership
is
the
computer nerd Chuck is forced to his birthday party. His old roommate has spy stuff. Sends Chuck an email that changes him forever. The CIA sends agents to find him, and he has his first date in years. And that's just in the pilot.
Yeah. Like, if Alan and I were friends back in the day, we could have lived that out in real life. I would have been the nerd working at the store. And
I think Alan is Chuck.
It was kind of perfect. But yeah, so Leo, you're doing the right thing. And this is what a lot of the conversation was at the time, was be in control of your own situation and not necessarily jumping into these big networks and running your membership.
Good.
Because your people will support you and you just have to grow it from there.
I think it's a much harder play, but I think being independent has some advantages. And I think we have a job to do as, AI starts to take over. Technology is changing quite rapidly all of a sudden. We have a really important job to do to let people know what's going on, have them help them understand it and help them be real about it as opposed to, you know, buying the hype. Anyway, that's why we ask people to help us out by joining the club. We keep the price low, $7 a month. Get rid of all the ads. It's ad free for all the shows. You also get video for shows that are currently only audio, like Hands on Macintosh, Hands on Windows. The Untitled Linux Show, Micah's iOS Today, all of those, Scott Wilkinson's Home Theater Geeks, are now public, but audio only. If you want the video, join the club. You also get the Twit Plus feed, which has all the weird stuff that happens before every show and after them, and events like we did an Inside Twit this week. That was for club members to give them an insight on what's going on inside Twit. All of that for $7 a month. There are family plans. There are corporate plans, and if you want to pay more, you certainly can. We wouldn't stop you, but it sure helps. If we can get everybody to join, I think we'd have a future. I think we might be able to continue doing what we're doing. If we don't, we might not. twit.tv/clubtwit if you are not yet a member. Thank you, Doc Rock, for supporting what we're doing.
And if you're in the club and you have a storage question and you add me, I might
answer. You're in the club? Alan's in the club? See? See, yeah. We try to actually, and I would extend this to you, Doc, and also to you, Daniel, if you want a complimentary membership, we'll be glad to send you one. Just ask Benito.
I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in.
Good, good, good. Because that's one of the things I like about the club is a chance to have a conversation in our Discord with all of the people who are on the shows. The conversation is not just about the shows, by the way. While I was on vacation, I was getting some very valuable help from the good coders in our club on my advent of code problems. So,
you know, it's funny you mentioned all this because with the with Google and its all of its changes it does with the search algorithms, the big focus lately has been back on community, that those are the sites and groups that are starting to better favor with Google, where things are kind of going. Specialty sites, things with community involved, that's where the experts are. And so it's actually good to have all that kind of stuff still.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and we have an important job, and can I be honest, the real reason, you guys are my buddies, and I really want to keep doing this. I love it. I love getting people together like you guys and talking about stuff that matters and learning. Man, did I learn today from you, Alan Malventano, CLX and HBM and NPUs. Oh, oh my. Thank
and you.
You
almost got. You almost got any of those acronyms correct.
Am I right? It's not CLX. What is it?
CXL.
CXL.
HBM.
HBM. Never mind. Forget about it. Did I learn anything?
Let
no.
Let me tell you something.
Did I enjoy it? Yes, absolutely. Alan, you're the best. Fizon. Did I say that right?
That's correct.
Fizon SSD Technologies. If you're ready to build your ultimate AI workstation, you're going to get a Fizon for sure, right?
I mean, partially. Through our partners, yes.
Thank you, Alan. It's always great to see you. You really, I love your knowledge, and it's so nice to hear from you. Thank you so much. Thank you also, Doc Rock, speaking of knowledge, not just knowledge about technology, but knowledge about life. You are the guy.
Thank you.
I really, it's always a pleasure. I know you're going to be talking to Lisa tomorrow. We thank you and Ecamm for supporting the shows. We really appreciate it. And for coming on. Always great to have you. Is that
Yeah, you know, it was great because when the conversation came up, I was like, Katie, you know what? We should just call Lisa. Let's go on Twit. And Katie's like, I'm down with that. And then I knew that those two would hit it off.
Aww.
And Lisa's the best. And Katie and Lisa just like made instant friends. I'm like, I told you, she's super cool. The Leo dude's a little weird, but Lisa's cool.
That's why they don't let me on the calls. Gotta ask you, is that a koa paddle over your left shoulder there? Do you go
out? Yes. It is a koa paddle, and it is, I didn't make it, though. It was a gift.
Beautiful.
But, yeah, I mostly use it in case anybody comes in here and tries to test my cybersecurity.
We bought one. We were in Hana, and we bought a koa paddle and brought it back, and it hangs on the wall. And it's how I know our subwoofers are working. Because when Tom Cruise flies over in a jet, it shakes. It vibrates. It goes... Thank you.
That's super funny.
Thank you, Doc Rock. Great to have you on. I really appreciate it.
Man, I appreciate you. Mahalo.
Mahalo. And thank you to Daniel Rubino, Windows Central Editor-in-Chief. Anything you want to plug, Daniel, while you're here?
Nah.
Yeah, you never...
We do the podcast.
I always try to get you to take advantage of this here. Listen.
We have our podcast. I'll just say it's going to be a very exciting summer. Computex is going to be massive this year.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot going on. And I think it's a lot of exciting technology. So pay attention to Windows Central.
I think you said something really interesting, which is 2025 is going to be the next big year for PCs. This is the time you're going to start to see those new technologies emerge. The Qualcomm chips are coming out this summer. The elites. Yeah. I think Windows on ARM is going to take off. This is the place to go to follow that. All the gaming, all the Surface stuff. WindowsCentral.com.
Yeah, handheld gaming is growing quite a lot. We expect Microsoft to enter that space maybe in the next year or two.
I heard that rumor. You think that's genuine?
Oh yeah, Phil Spencer loves, because I mean since he runs the division and he loves handheld gaming, he has all the handhelds out there, but he also knows the problem, which is Windows, and so he wants to bridge that gap between Xbox and PC, and he sees handheld gaming as the vector to do that.
So it would run the Xbox OS.
It'll run something akin to that, or some way that they can make it so that there's less friction right now and that you can get cross saves. Yeah. So I think you'll definitely see the metaverse space, but they're going to, I think, take a little bit of time there. And then I think AR glasses are going to be equally, you know, Vision Pro is out there, but you want to see different companies enter this market and try to find a middle ground between super expensive and like something that's kind of cheap. And then, yeah, AI and PCs and NPUs, I think, are going to be a really big story.
It's so, an exciting time.
ARM's going to be great.
Yep.
Yeah, ARM, you're going to see a lot of OEMs jump into that for the first time.
Yeah.
So it's going to be kind of fun.
Good. You know, I run Windows on my Mac, on my M3, and it runs beautifully. Windows on ARM runs beautifully on it in emulation.
They needed Chrome.
Yeah.
They needed
now they've got Chrome.
That was
now
the Chrome. One thing.
Yep. Chrome on ARM is Google announced it. We didn't cover that, but yeah, that's huge. Thank you, Daniel, Alan, Doc. Thanks to all of you who joined us. We do this show Sundays, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. You can watch us do it live. We return to the live stream on YouTube only, though. So go to youtube.com/twit. When the show begins, you'll get a notification if you click that bell there and subscribe. And you can watch the whole thing live. You know, kind of spoils the Monday commute, though. I think maybe better to subscribe and download it. You can download it from the website, twit.tv, or subscribe in your favorite podcast client. And that way you'll have it as soon as we've done cleaning it up, you'll have it ready for your Monday morning commute. Join the club and you can download the ad-free version, which saves about 4 hours of the total time. No, it doesn't. But how long were the ads? Maybe 10 minutes today. So you save a little. You save a little bit. What else? I think that's about it. Next week, a live studio audience should be interesting. And in 2 weeks, we are going to celebrate the 19th anniversary of this show. Hard to believe.
Crazy.
We're entering our 20th year doing this show. Isn't that amazing?
The Twit can almost drink. Isn't that nuts?
It can vote. Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We'll see you next time. And as I've said for the last 19 years, another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.
This is amazing.